Hey friends, it looks like it's 10 o'clock plus a minute, so let's go ahead and get started. Just to orient everybody, you're here with the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and my name is Janice Bellucci. I'm the founder of the Alliance, and I'm also the current executive director. And with me today is Chance Overstein, and Chance is the president of the board of directors of the Alliance. In addition to which, both Chance and I wear multiple hats. He's a criminal defense attorney, and I'm a civil rights attorney. So I hope by now you've heard of the organization and heard of us, but just in case you haven't, I wanted to invite you to go to our website. And our website, it's a long one, but here we go, www and then .all, number four, con, CON, and then SOLaws, plural, .org. So all four con, SOLaws.org. Now, there's lots of reasons to go to the website. One is we have lots of stories about relevant activities, events, and the like that are going on, including surveys. And there was a recent survey, and it's my understanding that the gentleman who's running the survey got about 500 responses, and he's very grateful for that. Many of you and people who go on the AXPA website, you're the ones who, in fact, responded to him. So I thank you for doing that. You know, because what's happening, he's gathering data, and then he's going to share the data with us once he's got all the responses in. So the other thing is for you to get notices about these monthly meetings, reminders about these monthly meetings, if indeed you go to the website, and then there's a box on the right-hand side that basically, if you share either your phone number with us or your email address with us, either one, then you'll get put on the list that's we send out notices about these meetings. And folks, we don't send that many notices out. We're not going to spam you with all kinds of information. We are very deliberate in what we send to you because we know a lot of people, and I've me included, right? We get a lot of emails and a lot of text messages that we don't necessarily want. So we're not going to send you things you're not interested in. And so if you would sign up there, that would make the things easier. And like I believe, and Roger's the one who sends these notices out. So I think he sends one out, about 2 weeks in advance, 1 week in advance, and I think the day before the event. Again, just to remind you, and you can join if you want to, and not join if you don't want to. So anyway, please do that. And there's another thing I want to talk about before we get to the main topics of today's meeting, and that's about scams. So I don't know if it's because it's spring and the scammers have woken up, out of hibernation or what's going on, but all of a sudden it seems that there's an increase in the number of scammers who are contacting people and asking people who are on the registry for money. Now, it's my understanding that these scammers, I have only spoken to one, but I've never been called by one. And the fact is, it's my understanding, and you all can add to it if you have had your own experience, but when they call you, they have a very emotional delivery. And they say things like, you didn't do something you were supposed to do. One of the latest ones was that they were saying wrongly, by the way, that somebody had to come and give their DNA sample again and said something about the DNA sample being required twice a year. Well, that's utter nonsense. But when they say it and they say, oh, and if you don't come right in, we're going to put out a warrant for your arrest. And in fact, we're going to send a squad car to come pick you up now. So, and some of these, I think they must be like theater majors or something like that, because in the background you can hear, what sounds like you're the police station or something like that, the typical noises and all that. But it's really easy to deal with a scammer. Okay. This is how you do it. You hang up the phone. Okay. That's it. And they beg you not to hang up the phone, by the way. And all you have to do is hang up the phone. Now, I understand there are some people on the registry who delight in making the life miserable of the person who called them. But why bother? Why spend your energy that way? We really recommend that what you do is you just hang up the phone, right? They don't, most of them, in fact, I don't think even one of them do they get a call back. It's just hang up the phone. You don't have to tell them that they're pond scum or that they've disturbed your day or anything like that. Just don't give them money either, by the way. And so, unfortunately, we know, Chance and I know of a gentleman in Los Angeles County who gave a scammer $10,000. And folks, when you give them the money, you don't get it back. Okay. And you should never, if anybody says that they're part of local law enforcement or any law enforcement and they want you to pay them money, that should also be a huge red flag for you saying, this is not law enforcement. And so, we've had people who said, oh, yeah, meet me at the police station. And then the next thing they go, well, meet me in the parking lot behind the police station or the side of the police station or whatever like that. Because guess what? They're not really cops. And most of the time when they do that too, they make sure that the police station or the sheriff's department is closed, right? That particular office is closed because they don't want you walking into the police department, right, with this person saying, hey, he says he's Sergeant so and so. Is that true? But again, the easiest thing to do, folks, and please do it, is just hang up on them. Okay. Is there anybody that's on the call right now that has been had a scamming experience and would like to share? Is there anybody? If so, go, if you would be so kind, go down to reactions and put your hand up, or you can wave. If I can see your face and you wave, we can do the old school. And again, here we go. Here's somebody who has. Okay. JD1708, I've asked you to unmute.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I had that scammer, and he kind of talks with a southern drawl. He originally called after I had moved and re-registered at 6:30 in the morning, and so he woke me up, and I was very disoriented. And he again said, "I'm so and so. There's a warrant out for your arrest." And so I called. I told him after I figured out why would they be calling my old address when there's a new address. So I did call and double check with the sheriff's department and the police department. He had told me to go to a sheriff's department, but I knew the police were the registering agency in the town. He then called about a month later to my new address and said the same thing. And then last year, he called my 93-year-old mother and tried to get her to send money. So be very careful.
And I don't know the specifics, but I will. Thank you for sharing that, by the way, JD. But I do know that whatever they say is very emotional. And I guess it would certainly get your attention at 6:30 in the morning if somebody says there's a warrant out for your arrest. And some of these folks say, and we're sending a car to your house right now.
Exactly.
Unless you do the following. Okay. Well, thanks, JD. Looks like
Yep.
Joe has his hand up. Joe?
Yes, I got a call. It's been over a year now, but they are very convincing. I was a computer professional for several years. I know about scamming, but because of the emotional effect that being on the registry has, I didn't catch on until the guy said, money. When he said money, then I knew it was not right. But the big thing is they want you to stay on the phone. They say they're tracking your phone so that you can't call somebody else to verify.
No, I need some.
They had background sounds that sounded like a police station in the call. So everybody be on the alert.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Tom, I think you had your hand up. I don't, but you took it down. Tom, is there something you wanted to share with us? And Tom, can you unmute yourself, please? There you go.
Yeah, I received this was about a year, year and a half ago, received a spam call again. Somebody representing themselves from the police department, and I don't know how legal this is, but I says, "Hey, look," I said, "I'm on my way to work. Do me a favor, just call me at my work number." And I go, "Okay." So I gave him my work number, the state police.
Good for you. Okay.
So I am not a member of the state police, never have been, but so I
You happen
thought,
to have the number handy.
and the state police didn't come over and say, "Hey, stop giving our number out."
Yeah. I don't, folks, I don't know how people get your phone number. I mean, that's truly a mystery. Sometimes I think that there's somebody like it's an inside job, right? But because it's happening all over the state or all over the country, I doubt it. So I don't, again, but just please, again, be aware that it seems that the activity, a level of the scammers is increasing right now. And again, the easiest and best way for you to deal with them is just hang up. Just hang up. You don't have to talk to them. You really, literally don't. Okay. So I was going to interject,
Janice, that
yes, please.
When one is on the registry, that it's easy to look up your name and then do a Google search, and typically your telephone number pops right up with it, and then the calls. So unless you can scrub your Google presence, which is pretty hard to do, because your personal information, telephone number and whatnot, is all over Google. Hence, I use Tom X. But nonetheless, being on a registry, they can do a quick lookup.
Sure.
And get your phone number and call you. That's all.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Hey, isn't it a good thing this isn't punishment being on the registry? Sorry, a little sarcasm for the morning. Okay. So we're going to proceed. Marty, do you want to say something? I see you in the chat room. Do you want to go ahead and talk? Marty?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Please share.
Okay. Well, when I first got out after my adjudication, I was staying at the home of a friend, and the only people who had that information were a couple of close friends, some really close family members, and these people would never give out my information. They would never endanger me in any way, shape, or form, and probation. So unless they had some kind of magic crystal ball, the only way Inside Edition could have gotten that information was through somebody in the probation office. So I don't personally trust law enforcement to keep our information personal and private if they have it.
I'm afraid that you're right. And I don't, well, I'll put it this way. I agree with you. I don't trust them to keep it confidential either. So they may be the leakers. I'm not sure. Okay, so let's go ahead. And I appreciate the people's comments there about the scammers and the experiences that you've had, and Marty, your experience as well. And so what we normally do in these monthly meetings is we talk about some topics, or we list some topics, and then have you vote on them. Because what we want to do is we want to give information to the greatest number of people, and the information that's, you know, relevant to you. And by the way, these meetings last usually a couple of hours. You don't have to stay on if your house is burning down, your dog needs to be fed, whatever it is. You're not going to hurt my feelings, and I'm just pretty sure not going to hurt chances either. But we really do this as a public service and do it on a monthly basis because we want to provide you with an update on several really important issues. But we also want to give you a chance to ask a question or make a comment about them. So let's go ahead and go to the first issue. Let me tell you what the issues are and then ask you to vote on them. One of them is SORNA regulations. The next one is the American Law Institute, or ALI, and what's happening with the Model Penal Code. Then about military veterans or retirees from being denied access to bases, and the tiered registry law. And I'm going to throw in domestic and international travel. Good morning, Kathleen, because I think at this point in time, things are looking up and more people are planning to travel or actually traveling. So again, SORNA regulations, the ALI Model Penal Code, military retirees getting on a basis, the tiered registry law, and domestic and international travel, those five issues. So you can vote on each one of them if you want. You don't have to limit yourself to one. But let me ask right now, how many people would like Chance and I to discuss the SORNA regulations today? And if you do, please put your hand up. Again, use under reactions. And it even counts for me. I figured this out last time. It was awesome. And I see some people with their actual hands up. Maybe for some reason you can't use the reactions button down there. That's fine. Okay. We got someone who had two hands up. Or maybe they're clapping. Anyway. Okay. People are still voting. I got a hands up and a thumbs up. Okay. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I think we've got about 24 people, 25 people there. All right. So next topic is the ALI Model Penal Code. How many people are interested in hearing about the ALI Model Penal Code, or have a question about it, or may want to make a comment? voting on ALI model penal code.
It's like a and reaction down again.
This is
just kidding. I found it.
And folks, right now everybody is unmuted, or at least it's possible for you to speak. And so, if you don't want us to hear with some background, you might want to turn off. You want to mute yourself. Okay, it looks like we have about 20 people for that. All right, please take your hands down. And the next issue is about military retirees who are currently being denied access to military bases. Let's see how many people want us to discuss that issue. If you do, this is time to put your hand up. I see you, John Garner. Okay. okay. I think we've got about maybe 8 or 10. I'll just say 10 people on that issue. The next issue is the tiered registry. What's happening here in California on our new tiered registry law that took effect, at least the petitioning process of it took effect on July 1 of last year. So if you're interested in knowing more about the tiered registry law here in California, and so I know there are folks who don't live in California who are interested in this as well. So more people coming.
I'm actually working on an interstate compact to California, so it's super important for me.
All right. Thank you for that extra. I've got a lot of hands there. I think we probably have about 25 there as well with the tiered register, or SORNA regs. And then the last one has to do with travel, whether it's domestic travel or international travel. If you have some questions about, you know, what are the rules of the road when you travel, whether, again, you're traveling within the United States or you're traveling outside the U.S., unfortunately, there are things you need to think about before you go somewhere. Okay. People are still voting. Sounds like popcorn on my screen here. Okay. I think we have about 20 people on that as well. Okay. So let's go ahead and get started. I know we have some people who've just joined us. So let me just introduce myself again. My name is Janice Bellucci. I am an attorney in California, and I am the executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. I founded the organization a little over 10 years ago, and we've been very busy during those 10 years. So the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws is a nonprofit organization. We consider ourselves to be a national organization, and so it's good to see many people who are from outside California, because we care about your issues too, and certainly SORNA regulations, military retirees, and other issues like that affect people regardless of where you live. And then Chance Arborstein, sorry, Chance. Chance Arborstein is with us. Chance is president of the board of directors of the Alliance, and he's a criminal defense attorney. So Chance and I complement each other very well. In other words, he is the criminal defense attorney. So if you get charged with a criminal defense, call Chance Arborstein. Don't call Janice Bellucci, because I will just say, call Chance, and here's his phone number.
And vice versa, by the way. If you've got a civil issue or you've got stuff that has to do with civil rights, call Janice.
Right. And one example, like, you know, Chance and I are working together on a case with the same person who has a licensing issue, right? And which is civil, and he also has a criminal defense issue. So in this case, both Chance and I are working. Maybe it's like going to get a manicure and a pedicure at the same time. Sorry, right. Gentlemen, if right. You haven't done that. Okay, so let's talk about SORNA regulations now. The SORNA regulations are a multi-headed beast, I guess, is one way for me to look at it. And it's something that the federal government proposed like a year and a half ago, approximately. So in August of 2020, the federal government issued in the Federal Register these proposed federal regulations that, in fact, are part of SORNA. So it's and there's some really awful provisions in there. There really are. And if, in fact, everybody had to live by the SORNA regulations and do every single thing in the SORNA regulations, your lives would be different. Right. And you would have more burdens than you have today. So the question is, to whom do they apply? Oh, by the way, they do become effective in January of this year. So despite the fact that over 700 responses were filed in response to the proposed federal regulations, they basically were passed. And there's very few changes made between the proposed regulations and the final regulations. So we're trying to figure out, again, to whom does this apply? And you would say, well, isn't that perfectly clear? The answer is no. So if you look at SORNA and the SORNA laws that existed even before these regulations, the definition to them of who is a, quote, sex offender is anybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense. Now think about that. Anybody who has ever been convicted. So that would include people who are no longer required to register. Just let that sink in for a minute. So in California, with our new tiered registry law, and I'm so excited, and people are getting off the registry, and yet maybe these sort of regulations will abide them, even if they're no longer required to register in California. Now, I say maybe because we don't know for sure. And it's this uncertainty. You know, I feel like there's something hanging, the sword of Damocles, you know, hanging above my neck. It's going to fall any minute like a guillotine and chop my head off. That's an extreme statement, and I don't mean it literally. But the fact is, how does one live one's life not knowing whether or not these provisions of the SORNA regulations apply to you? So I know when we wrote our response to the regulations, we wrote, you know, our response was like a law review article. It was more than 30 pages long. It was full of footnotes. It was full of legal discussion, you know, and the facts as applied. And basically, one of the things we said that was wrong with the proposed regulations was that they were vague and ambiguous, because starting with who does this apply to? And of course, in the final regulations, it didn't clarify that. So we still don't know to whom the SORNA regulations apply. And so, you know, and it's like, well, why does that make a difference? One of the differences, at least for folks, and well, in most states, is if you were to leave your home for 7 days or longer, no matter if you stayed in the same state, the SORNA regulations say you have to notify your local law enforcement official. And I tell you, in California, if you were to do that, they would ask, why are you here? Because right now in California, there's no such requirement. You leave your home, let's just say you live in San Diego, you want to go visit the Bay Area, and you're going to be gone for 10 days. You don't tell anybody. You just go. And you don't have an obligation to do that under state law. So the question is, with this federal law, does this apply to, you know, me as a registrant, or doesn't it? And again, Chance and I, you know, we're, I think, of the same mind here, which is we don't know. We don't know if it applies to you or not. And so we're unfortunately waiting to see what's going to happen and who the federal government might pursue. Here's another one that's really basic. And that is, under the SORNA regulation, some people are going to have to register 4 times a year. Now, in California, most people, over 90%, maybe 95% of people in California, register 1 time a year. So what is going to happen if you go into your registration office and say, hey, these federal SORNA regulations tell me I have to register 4 times a year. So I'm here. 3 months later, I'm here to register again. What do you think the registration officer is going to say? I think they're going to say, get out of here. We only do it once a year. But I'm not sure. And then the bigger question, of course, is, well, if you fail to register 3 or 4 times a year, are you in violation of federal regulations? And can the federal government arrest you, charge you with a crime, and convict you? It's a lot of uncertainty, folks. And I know, Chance, you had something you can add to that, some things that you can add to that. So would you please?
I think you covered it really well. I mean, the bottom line is there's a lot of uncertainty. We, you know, we have some inklings of how the federal government has viewed California in terms of SORNA before. We have evaluations that are done on states that are compliant and semi-compliant, and those evaluations are published. And what I've noticed is one Attorney General Gonzalez, published a report and said that California is different in terms of SORNA when it comes to our dismissals, not our certificates of rehabilitation, not our remedies of bringing or of taking people off the registry, but that our dismissals are different because there's no penal consequences after the dismissal. And therefore, it takes it, according to his evaluation, out of the definition of SORNA. Now, that's interesting because in 2016, I think, which is the last assessment that the Department of Justice did, they seemed to say the exact same thing in detail. But these are just evaluations. This has nothing to do with case law. It has nothing to do with any rule or regulation other than the thinking of the Department of Justice at the time. It lends for a lot of uncertainty, but I can certainly see how they view the California remedy of dismissal as compared to other forms in other states. Escaping that definition. So that's one aspect of it. The other thing is that, you know, given what Janice has said, we have yet, unless anyone in this meeting can tell us that they've been advised otherwise, have yet to see this bleed into the state or any of the registration requirements that you're going through right now, which even lends to more uncertainty because apparently there's no handshake between the federal government and the state. But it would be interesting to know if any of you have been affected by these new rules and regulations.
Chance, I'm looking over in the chats, and there is somebody who has given us some input that basically says when he went to do his annual registration, there was no mention of the SORNA regulations. And the reason, folks, that that's important is because in order for the SORNA regulations to apply to you, you need to be notified by some form of government. It could be the state government. It could be the federal government. When Chance was just talking about the, states that are SORNA compliant, there are only 18 states in the United States that are SORNA compliant. So that's just a hair over one third of the states in the United States that are SORNA compliant. So the huge question is, again, does this apply to you? Now, if were convicted under federal law, there's a greater chance that these regulations would apply to you. Because you're under federal jurisdiction already because of that, but it's still not 100% certain. So we think that until the government specifically notifies you that these SORNA regulations apply to you, you at least have a good defense. Now, that doesn't mean that you won't be arrested or charged with a crime, but at least when it comes time to defend yourself in court, then you have the defense that I didn't know. And so meetings like this, by the way, and Chance and I talking to you about this, and we even had a webinar about the SORNA regulations, that doesn't count. It has to be government to notify you, to formally notify you that the SORNA regulations apply to you. How could this come about? How would the government notification come? In California, I'm serious in saying this to you. In California, our state government said they didn't have enough money to mail a letter to all the registrants. We have 108,000, by the way, telling them what their tier assignment was. And the tier assignment letter is one page. So think about that. The state government, and by the way, California, in case you don't know it, is the fifth largest economy in the world, not in the nation, but in the world. Okay. And our state Department of Justice said they didn't have enough money to mail one letter to everybody on the registry, which I find ludicrous. I hope you do too. Okay. So then if somebody's going to notify you that the SORNA regulations apply to you, I think that it has to be more than a one page letter. I think they actually have to send the SORNA regulations to you, right? So if they don't have enough money to tell you what your tier assignment is, I would be really surprised if they mailed you a letter. This is state governments, right? What the feds are going to do, who knows? Who knows? But okay, so this is a good time. I see there's already three hands up. I hope it's about SORNA regulations. If it's not, we're going to ask you to wait. But the first one is Murrieta, so I'm asking Murrieta to unmute. And other folks, if you have a specific question about the SORNA regulations, or if you, in fact, have a comment about them, please, this is the time to ask as we're waiting for Murrieta to unmute him or herself. That might be the city of Murrieta. Hope not. I've sued them. Oh, anyway, not on this point, but anyway, Murrieta isn't, Murrieta just left. So now we've got the Herreras. So I'm going to ask the Herreras to unmute themselves. And I will tell you that, we've got, some litigation that's, we expect to come about pretty soon, that will in fact challenge the SORNA regulations. And I'll speak to that in a minute. So now somebody has the last three digits of 700 and a phone number. There's no name. Area code 818 and then 700 is the last three digits. Please unmute yourself if you have a question or a comment about SORNA regulations. I hope our system is working okay. It did earlier, so I'm just going to trust that it did. Maybe somebody put their hand up and didn't mean to, so I'm going to lower their hand. All right, does anybody have a question about the SORNA regulations, what they say, when they went into effect, who did they apply to, any of those things before I talk about this litigation? Oh,
okay. Yeah, this is Daryl.
Oh, hi.
Thank you. Hey, regarding the registration, I literally just went on Tuesday to register. He told me he knew absolutely nothing about SORNA or the 4-time-a-year compliance. And I noticed in the paperwork that I signed, they kind of have a catch-all phrase in there that says something like, I'm responsible for any changes in the law that happens after I sign, kind of just basically dumping it on me. Is there any sort of law that says that if there's a change in the law that they are supposed to notify me, or am I just responsible for constantly trying to keep updated with all the different state and federal laws?
Well, my answer is there's no clear answer to that question. And Chance, you want to speak to it as well?
I think that's in reference to Dobie Harris, which was a case a while back, which said that if you, based your plea or your settlement on the current state of the law, if there's any changes in 290 regulations, you're still subject to them, even though they weren't around when you settled your case. I think that's what it refers to. It refers to state law. I don't think it necessarily refers to federal requirements. And again, and I've looked in the chat room there, some people have said, well, talking about ignorance of the law and things like that. You have to have some form of notice that you are required to do something that you didn't otherwise know about. So that's what we were talking about as far as notice goes on the federal side. On the state side, when changes come into effect, you're responsible to adhere to those changes as they come down legislatively. I think that's what that little section means.
Yeah.
You know how many registrants there are in California and the United States?
In California, it's over 108,000 people on the registry. And nationwide, it's somewhere between 900 and I think 950,000.
Wow, so they'd have to mail out almost 1 million notices, federal government would.
That's what they should do.
They don't necessarily have to do that. They can just simply have you comply through your registration requirements, verbal notice through law enforcement if they wanted to. That's what I'm saying. That's why it makes it so confusing. But yeah, it would, no matter how you cut it, it's costly. Let's put it that way. And it's caused a real gray area where, we haven't really been able to put our finger on where these things are going yet.
Yeah. So we've got another hand up, someone who calls him or herself Zoom user. So Zoom user, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. Oops. I think I just muted you. There you go.
Thank you, first off, Janice and Chance. My question is, how are they able to keep pulling this ex post facto stuff? Like when I took a deal, I wasn't convicted. So by trial, I took a deal, which was we made a bargain, right? And then they keep just upping the price. They keep upping the price. Like we had a deal, it was a bad deal, but it keeps getting worse.
Right. Well, it's all because of a decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court almost 20 years ago. And that decision is called Smith versus Doe. And in that decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that being on the registry is not punishment. So every time I have to utter those words, I have to admit, I think I should go find a barf bag because I really don't believe in it. I believe that being on the registry is punishment. And I've seen so many people who are being punished, and I've heard so many stories about people being punished. But because the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that registration is not punishment, then it does not, that means that the laws don't trigger the ex post facto clause. And it's the ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution that protects people, is supposed to protect people from new laws being applied retroactively, especially when it comes to your criminal offense. I mean, if you think about it, the basis of criminal law is allegedly, you know, things we learn in law school, is that, oh, before you decide to stab somebody to death, you're going to think about, gosh, gee whiz, if I stab something to death, someone to death, this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to get convicted of murder, and I'm going to go to prison for a long time, if not my entire life, and say, oh, it's either worth it or it's not worth it, right? So this just destroys that, because if, in fact, you are thinking, before I commit the sex offense, what is the punishment going to be? Oh, okay. Well, I think it's worth 10 years in prison. No. Does anybody really do that? No. But that's what this criminal law is supposed to be based upon. So that's why these laws are not supposed to be applied retroactively. And yet, because of the Supreme Court decision, they are being applied retroactively at every level of the government, whether it's a city, a county, the state, and, oh, by the way, the federal government as well. So these SORNA regulations, to me, are ex post facto.
Well, yeah, they are ex post facto. In fact, and the thing is that we're being so intellectually dishonest about it, starting with Smith. But in Smith's day, you know, maybe you could argue that they were kind of unobtrusive and maybe they weren't punishment in terms of how it was perceived by argument. But the fact is that since then, because of the outgrowth and all the things that have happened since then, it morphed into and should be recognized as punishment if it wasn't punishment exactly when it was being discussed in that case. Now, the other thing is that it's intellectually dishonest. Take, for instance, the pandemic. Look at this. People are saying, why are you punishing us for not getting vaccinated? Okay, we're being isolated. We're being excluded. We're feeling like, you know, we're a pariah in our society. Well, What do you think that this law does to those who have to register? But it's easy enough to say in the pandemic you're being victimized and as punishment. How is it that we're stupid when it comes to talking about issues regarding the burdens that have been put on registrants? It's just totally intellectually dishonest.
And I totally agree with Chance on that. So, folks, I think that's a good segue for something like a commercial right now. So here we go. In March of next year, so basically 1 year from now, we are gathering in Washington, D.C., and we very much want you to join us. So what we're doing in Washington, D.C. is to tell the U.S. Supreme Court that they made a big, big mistake. So in their decision here, Smith versus Doe, that they made a mistake, and we want to be very specific and let them know the consequences of their mistaken decision. Now, there have been a couple of cases that have tried to get to the U.S. Supreme Court for review. One of them was the Doe versus Snyder case that focused on the Michigan sex offender laws, and the court refused to review that decision. So if the court gets to decide what cases it hears, right? And it's like, well, how do we get them to listen to us and to understand the harm that they've caused? Well, one way to do it is go to their front door. So in March of next year, actually it's March 7th, please put that on your calendar. Please come to Washington, D.C. If there's any way that you can do that, bring your family, bring your friends. We need to let the court know that they've made a terrible mistake. And by the way, the court's made other terrible mistakes. And two of them I'll bring up right away are, one is called Plessy versus Ferguson. And the Plessy versus Ferguson case, that's when the U.S. Supreme Court said, oh yeah, separate but equal education, that's just fine with us. Right. And unfortunately, it took them over 50 years to overturn that decision. And most of us know that that decision better than Plessy versus Ferguson because it's Brown versus Board of Education. So the U.S. Supreme Court sometimes corrects their mistakes. And another mistake that they made, and it's very it's actually personal to me, even though I'm not of Japanese descent, but my roommate in law school, her family was of Japanese descent, and both of her parents were in internment camps here in California because of the Korematsu case that the U.S. Supreme Court mistakenly decided. So folks, the court makes mistakes, and sometimes they clean them up. So we need to go and we need to educate them and let them know what a terrible mistake that they've made, and that being on the registry is indeed punishment. So I know we have somebody waiting here. David is his first name. David, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. And we were talking about the SORNA regulations, so we did get off on a tangent there about Smith versus Doe case and going to Washington next year. So, David, what would you like to talk about today?
I'm going to, at least on the fringe of it, Justice Jackson's in the news a lot right now. One of the U.S. senators, I think it's Hawley, is going after her because of her comments on sex offenders and punishment. I know that it's helpful, but how helpful will she be if she ascends to the Supreme Court?
It's never known. When people are elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court, guess what? They've got a job for life, and they can't be recalled. But I guess maybe it's happened before, but it very rarely happens. So who knows? But I mean, I'd rather have her on the court than not have her on the court. And Sotomayor, the same, you know, she's already on the court. And quite frankly, she has said some things that indicate that they might have an understanding, right? They might actually understand what a mistake that the Supreme Court made. So I personally hope that she gets confirmed. And having said that, I don't think it's a guarantee that she would make the right vote, but we can always hope so. By the way, in the case of Smith versus Doe, it was not unanimous. Unfortunately, two of the justices who joined the dissent are no longer there. And one of them was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they said, we understand. We understand this is punishment, right? And, you know, whatever was going on in Alaska at the time, and by the way, at that time, that was the sex offender laws that were at issue in Smith versus Doe, was the state of Alaska. Well, in the state of Alaska, you didn't have to go in person to register. They mailed you the registration form. You filled it out, you mailed it back. That was it. That's what the registration process that the Supreme Court was looking at. So maybe it made sense. And they specifically said in the majority opinion, this doesn't affect employment, this doesn't affect housing, this doesn't affect your family life. Well, we know now all those three things are in fact affected if you're on the registry. So the laws today are very different. And quite frankly, that's something in Doe versus Snyder, the case that Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals case, a decision that looked at Smith versus Doe said, hey, we understand that in Smith versus Doe, that might not be punishment. But let me tell you about the sex offender laws in Michigan today. And the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals decision is brilliant. And it's like, I have real mixed feelings about the fact that the court wouldn't review it. I mean, the state of Michigan wanted the Supreme Court to review that decision because they didn't like it, right? And the registrants were happy, even though it's still been a mixed bag in Michigan. So, John, I'm trying to ask you to unmute. You've got your hand up. I don't know if you have your hand up on purpose or not. If you don't, join us in just a minute. I'll go ahead and start talking about the litigation. So there you are. So, John?
Yeah, so I kind of can't really talk 100% where I am. I put it in the chat.
Okay. Okay. Let me go look in chat. Oh, there you are. Oops. Oh dear. I don't, Chance, maybe you're having a better luck with the chat, but supposedly John, here he goes. What happens if our probation tries to restrict that travel to support that? I'm not sure what you're talking about and what
to go to DC for that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, if you can't go, you can't go. And so we understand that if you're on paper, parole, probation, or supervised release, you have to ask permission to travel. And if you can't join us, then you will be missed. And we hope that you'll still make a donation to the cause because there's going to be a conference as well as a vigil. And in addition to which, we're going to talk about, we're going to have meetings on Capitol Hill. So we hope you can join us, John, but if you can't, we will try out.
I guess question, isn't it because part of our constitutional right is to have the right of assembly, to protest things? Is there a way that I could get around that if I did want to attend?
When you're on parole, probation, or supervised release, you don't have all your constitutional rights. So that's not going to work. Sorry. Okay. Rafael, you have your hand up. Go ahead and call on you now.
Thank you for taking me. Thank you, Janice. Thank
you're welcome.
Janice. I think that we also need to point that the collateral damage to our family members has increased tremendously since the time that this Supreme Court decision was passed, because now anybody, the first thing they do when they react to and interact with somebody new is to look at the website. And they have these commercial websites nowadays that not only they list you as a resident of an address, but all your relatives, any guests that live in that address. So everybody gets contaminated by your stigma. And there are some serious consequences for these people because they also feel isolated, marked, and have tremendous repercussions from that stigma.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And so when we think about how many people on the registry, technically there are almost 1 million people on the registry, but if you multiply that by 2 or 5, you think about there might be 5 million people who are directly affected by the requirement to register. I totally agree with you. Okay, we have a couple more hands up. So Zoom user, you're back. Do you have a question or comment about SORNA regulations?
This is not SORNA. This is Adam Walsh Act. My question was, like, I understand they pulled us on Megan's Law, and then they kept up in the ante, and when they make these new laws, how do they link it back to us, even though the law didn't exist? Is it with that Doe case that you were talking about?
Yes, Smith versus Doe. Unfortunately, yes.
And I want to mention, I had an issue with the Adam Walsh Act because I married an immigrant wife. And then we found out we had to go in front of some type of panel to get approval if she could even get a citizenship. And I was like, what the hell country are we living in? You know, like, I was surprised they even thought of some crazy stuff like this.
No, you're absolutely right. And I know several people who have faced that issue, including we have a fellow board member whose first name is Alex. So if you want to contact me separately, I will give you Alex's contact information. He is not even on the registry anymore. His requirement to register has been terminated. And despite that, they're still for a couple more years, even after that, they said that he poses a danger to his wife. I mean, think about it, folks. You know, if you were convicted, especially of an offense involving a minor, and your spouse is an adult, what do these two things have to do with each other? And it's really hard to prove a negative, which is, I'm not going to hurt my spouse. So it's not, you know, it doesn't make sense, but unfortunately, a lot of these laws don't make sense. Okay, John, you've got your hand up. Oops, there you go.
Good morning, Janice and Chance. Thank you again for everything you guys are doing for us. Raphael raised an issue about all the other links that tie in the registered sex offenders. And I'm wondering, those who have been removed from California's list were successful. Do you know if they've followed up or if you've been able to follow up to get any reference that's on Google or Facebook or any of the medias that, have additional information on us? I know a lot of them have taken the information from Megan's List, but has there been a follow-up to make sure that any of these other electronically or what do we call them, the IT communication systems are not still putting out the outdated information on those who've been removed from the list?
Okay, that's a good question, John, and I'm going to mute you again because I hear reverberation there. It's not automatic. You have to go to the website and ask them to take you off. And most of them require you proof. But if you have a court order, or if you have a letter from the California Department of Justice that says you're no longer required to register, they will take you off. Okay, we got, I don't know if it's the same John. No, I think that's the same John. Tom, I'm going to ask you to unmute here. You have your hand up.
Yeah. I'm recently off the registry, and I went out. Yeah, luckily, after too many years. So, anyways, I got my letters, I got my court orders and whatnot, and I was the court was a little slow on getting things to get me removed. So I took it upon myself, and I called the various entities. And they were very, very helpful here, government wise. And they asked for copies of my, court order, and I emailed it to them. And within a day, I was off. Then I did a Google search, and I was on maybe 4 or 5 different sites, and they were very fairly easy. I sent them a request asking them to remove me, and I didn't send them copies of my court order or anything else. I just simply said, please refer to the my state registry site. You will not find me or that name on that. And it was removed. On a second request, what I did is they have an area that says, you know, what state, and tell us why. And so what I did is I put, and they allow for a comment. And so I put in the comment that the second time that I am keeping a copy of my request to give to my state police if I'm not taken off your site immediately. And the next day I was off the site. And so I persisted with that over the various 3 or 4. And in one instance, apparently they didn't have a way to take a single individual off a site. They had to remove everybody from the state I was in. And
my goodness, you know, that's great.
I keep tabs on this. I do a search on myself roughly once a week to see if I pop up anywhere else. And so far I'm not. However, my name and my if you enter it in, they will put something like, well, this person is no longer on our site. And I'm going like, okay, kind of crappy way to do it. But, you know, it's better than, you know, having your picture and address and any other information that they can get a hold of and then cross-reference and get your phone number and then give you calls. So sure. It takes a little bit. It took me about maybe about a week, less a week plus a couple of days, because I didn't do that over the weekend simply because nobody's around.
Sure. Tom, can we ask what state you're in?
Yeah, Michigan.
In Michigan? All right, great. Thank you for that. And folks, I hope you learn from what Tom just said. He took some initiative here, and he did a bunch of homework himself. Right. And so there are no magic wands out there. You can't just, I don't think, sit there in your cocoon and think that, oh, gosh, gee whiz, the right thing's going to happen and do nothing. You really have to be assertive here. And I know sometimes it might be difficult to do that because maybe you feel that, you know, such shame and stigma about what happened, the fact that you're convicted of anything. But it's, you know, I'm here to tell you that you have power, and I'm encouraging you to use it. So it looks like Mark has a question or a comment. Mark W., I'm asking you to. There you go, unmute yourself.
Yep, takes a second. Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Tom, because I was wondering about that, getting removed from all the other places that mirror it. With their First Amendment rights, I mean, do they have to remove us, or can they just say, well, this person used to be registered, that's true, and we're going to say it? That's all of my questions.
Okay, that's a good question, Mark. I filed a lawsuit against a family of privately owned websites, and I was partially successful, but that issue of the First Amendment came up. So it depends how they present the information on their website. So like the person who I was trying to get him to stop, not just even listing people on a registry, on the website rather, but also to charge people $500 to get removed from their website, right? And they were really doing this. And think about it. There's almost 900,000 people on our current registrants, right? Times $500. That's a lot of money. And he was making a lot of money, and he does not like me. And I'm sure he remembers my name because I cost him a lot of money. But you know what? It needed to stop. And so that was stopped. But there are some websites out there that call themselves archives. And so if, in fact, they say that this is a list of everybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense, in most cases, the First Amendment does protect them. So, folks, we need to get back to SORNA. Almost an hour into this, and we haven't finished the first topic, so I don't want to rush things along too much, but I just want to say briefly that we are exploring a major lawsuit with another nonprofit organization. So our organization's been around for 10 years. Their organization's been around 50 years. We have 2 lawyers. They have 40 lawyers. We have no cases that ever been taken to the U.S. Supreme Court. They've had 16 cases been taken to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they won 14 of those 16. So we're talking again with a very powerful nonprofit organization that's interested in challenging the SORNA regulations. They've never engaged in a lawsuit on behalf of registrants, and quite frankly, that's not their primary motivation. The reason they care about challenging these regulations is that it has to do with the separation of powers. So, you know, the executive branch versus the legislative branch versus the judiciary. And they think that the attorney general overreached here in issuing these regulations. So we're not ready to make an announcement yet. We don't have a final agreement yet on the litigation and the litigation plan. But I'm hopeful that we will have a lawsuit filed in the month of May. So you can put that in pencil maybe on your calendar that a lawsuit's coming in May. But I'm very encouraged to have another organization that cares, because unfortunately, is there some out there that could care but choose not to care? So anyway, what are the initials? Oh, ACLU. Okay. Sorry about that. Why don't we go ahead and move on to the second issue? The second issue would be the ALI Model Penal Code. And so why don't I start that up and then Chance ask you to join me in some more information. So as far as I'm concerned, watching what the American Law Institute is doing with the Model Penal Code is like watching a tennis match. And, you know, you see the ball go one way and then the ball goes the other way. And I'm getting dizzy because the ball keeps going over the net, right? So I'm saying that because I'm going to tell you some things that have happened and you're going to say, well, that's confusing. And I agree, it's confusing. But the fact is this, the American Law Institute is a very prestigious organization. And this is where our highest level legal academics, judges, justices, you know, all the people and all those ivory towers gather, and they really do a great job. And so for 9 years, they studied the Model Penal Code that they had put together 50 years ago, a really long time ago. And they said, you know, things have changed. I think it's time to update our Model Penal Code. Who thought, right? So anyway, after a lot of hard work, they came up with a revised Model Penal Code. And part of that revised Model Penal Code affects people on the registry, or would affect people on the registry. And I mean, dramatically. So one of the things that I think everybody can understand how dramatic this would be is that no one would be required to register for more than 15 years. 15. Wow. I mean, I know people who've been on the registry for 50 years in California. So the fact is that 15 years would be the maximum, and most people would be able to be eligible to petition for removal after only 10 years. So that would be huge. It would also dramatically decrease the number of registrable offenses. And get this, it would make the registry available only to law enforcement and would no longer be public. I mean, those are three dramatic differences. So that's what the ALI members voted on in June of last year. So June 2021, ALI members overwhelmingly passed this Model Penal Code. Then it had to go to their council, their like a board of directors. And the council, or I'll just call it the ALI leaders, they considered it in beginning in January of this year. And then they couldn't come to a full agreement, so they waited till March, which was earlier this month. And what they did was they said, well, we think that this is going in the right direction, but we think we need to take half a step backwards. And one of the things that they took a step backwards on was the number of registrable offenses. So there originally, when the members voted on it, five categories of registrable offenses, the leadership, the council, they expanded that to 11 categories. And unfortunately, when it expanded, all of a sudden the CP offenses were included in registrable offenses. So that's the difference between June of last year and this month. What's happened next is it has to go back to the Model Penal Code has to go back to the members, the ALI members, and that's going to happen in May. So 2 months from now, the ALI members are going to look at what their leadership did, the changes the leadership made, and decide whether or not they want to approve that. And it's my understanding that there's at least one group of their members that basically want to revise what their leaders did. So I'm thinking the May meeting's not going to be the end either, but something eventually is going to come out of this. And hopefully it's going to be something that we want to take to each and every state legislature. Oh, by the way, the federal government too, and say, this is what we want. By the way, think about what effect this might have on the SORNA regulations, right? So the SORNA regulations are have all these nasty provisions in it. Well, guess what? It would apply to a heck of a lot fewer people, and some of them would just be erased by the ALI model penal code. Chance, please help and expand.
Well, I mean, before everybody gets real excited about all this, the model penal code has been around for a long, long, long time. And, you know, these are proposals, okay, of what ought to be, not what is. What happens is, is that people have different perspectives. Prosecutors have perspectives. Defense attorneys have perspectives. And academics have perspectives. The Model Penal Code group is composed of all of those. And so it, there seems to be a conflict and a war in between their perspectives. And they want to pound out a compromise as to what they would propose a penal code, any penal code in any state, should be with respect to this issue. Okay, so we don't know what the outcome is going to be. As Janice said, it is kind of like a tennis match or a ping pong match or whatever. You know, the interesting thing about it is that if it does happen to land favorable for us, we can use that, as Janice said, to lobby. We can say, look, this is what is in our state, but this is how it really should be, because these are the folks who are the brightest and the best of us. And they're saying that to make our penal code smart on crime and equitable towards everyone, these recommendations should be followed. Our penal code should be reformed to reflect these changes. Now that would be good for us, because we would immediately start pushing those changes through the legislative channels. That would be most helpful for us. So putting in perspective, we hope that they're going to be favorable, and we hope that we can use those proposals to help reform the penal code in our state to reflect those recommendations. Correct me if I'm wrong, Janice, did I say it right?
You did say it right. Thank you so much. So the ping pong or the tennis match is not over. We have to wait and see what comes out of ALI. If in fact it's favorable, then there's going to be a lot more work to do. Chance and I are not members of ALI. We're not academicians. We're street fighters. You know, we're the ones that go into court, help you in court. But we also are lobbyists, and we're going to ask you to help us lobby, and not just in California, but in every state. So we bring this up because there's been a lot of confusion about what in the heck is going on with, you know, with the ALI, and what they have to say is important. And a lot of people do pay attention. Trust me, if Chance and I said the things that the ALI are saying, people would just go on and say, who cares? But because it's ALI that's saying it, there's more people who in fact pay attention. So we've got a question or comment here, a phone number that ends in 869. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. My name's Eric. I just wanted to check whether that's suggested 15 years. I know it isn't law anywhere yet. When does it start? Do you have to wait? In my case, I have 20 years probation.
Well, they're saying
15 plus 20.
The way that it's written, it's 15 years of registration. So even if you're on paper, parole, probation, or supervised release, that would count. Just like in California, the tiered registry, the time you spend on paper counts toward the minimum number of years you're required to register.
Yes, okay. I understand that, but I do understand in California, yes, it counts, but you can't come off the register until you're off of probation.
Right, you're not eligible to petition.
So if you have 20 years time for an offense that's the 10-year level, but I can't do it until I'm off probation.
Are you under the federal system or state?
Federal.
Okay. I think you should contact Chance or I, because just because they tell you you have 20 years of supervised release does not necessarily mean you have 20 years of supervised release. You can file a motion for early termination. So let's just stop there. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I'm working towards that, and in fact, I was going to contact you guys.
Okay, so, good idea. Yeah, Chance, you want to say anything there before we go to the next caller?
No, I think we've covered it pretty good. There we go. Right.
John?
Yes. Yeah, so, for me, I just started. I just got sentenced like a month or two ago in the state of Utah, but. As I mentioned before, I'm doing an interstate compact to the state of California. On my probation agreement, in Utah, it states that, my registry time doesn't start until after, I'm finished with my sentencing, which that means, you know, to me, I interpreted that as once I'm off of probation. Will that change as I go to California, or how does that work?
Your question is way too specific for this group, so just contact Chance or I separately, please.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so back to the ALI model penal code. I don't think we have any more hands up, so that's what we know about the ALI model penal code. By the way, we have updates on our website on a regular basis about what's happening with the ALI model penal code. Please check there. If something really big is happening, then we do send out email messages and text messages about it. But again, we try not to send too many of those out. So it's going to have to be really significant for us to notify you about it. But we don't expect anything to happen, quite frankly, until May. The members meeting is 3 days, I believe, May 16, 17, and 18. So we probably won't know anything about the members' vote until maybe even May 20th. They're not real good at communicating to the external world. So let's go ahead and go on to the next topic. The next topic is domestic and international travel. And Chance, you are the master of both. So why don't you start us out on that, if you would?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the master, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll start us out. Let's take domestic travel. Domestic travel is traveling outside the state to any other state. Let's just start with the base state of California. If you're planning on taking a trip to any other state in the union or territory within the United States, you need to check those jurisdictions to find out how many days you can be there as a visiting registrant without having to register in that state. Why is that important? Because you don't want to register. The basic rule of the road here, if you're going to travel, is you don't want to register in any other state. You want to maintain only one registration only in one state. And I'm speaking now in terms of California being the example. You could take this to any state, you know, but this is as relevant to say Michigan as it is California, but I'm just using California as an example. So if you're a Californian, you're planning a trip, the best thing you can do is you can look at your agenda, your itinerary. You can then go to our website and take a look at, you know, what's the requirements. We have those posted, and you can start there. Now, I'm not saying that our website is the end all there, because it's a good sketch, but you might want to look on the computer once you get that information from our website to see if any updates exist. And you could even make a few calls, so that is, you plan your trip, you know exactly how much time you can spend in each place without having been required to register. Because the problem is that if you don't register and you're caught for any number of reasons that we never even think about, you could be facing some real liability if you know, like a felony conviction for failure to register. And that is ugly. And the other thing is that you can end up, if you do register in a state where you really ought to have not registered, you can end up being on that registry forever. And so even if you're relieved in California, your passport's still affecting everything else, because you're still being, you're still registered in that other state. So, you know, that is a sketch of it. And we'll take domestic travel first, and probably should answer questions before we move on to international.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. And so, folks, it's, you know, living your life on the registry or being a family member of a registrant is like being in a minefield. We understand that, Chance and I, and we're trying to help you safely navigate through the minefield without blowing up right? And blowing up to me means you go back to custody. So it's really important that you know before you travel somewhere what the laws are in that state. And unfortunately, they're not uniform. Or maybe it's fortunate. I don't know. I mean, it would be awful if they were all the same as Rhode Island. So Rhode Island says if you're going to be in the state for 24 hours or longer, you have to register there. So the good news about Rhode Island is it's a very small state. And so if you're going to go visit Aunt Sally at Thanksgiving, who lives in Rhode Island, you can get a hotel that's in another state, right? That allows you to stay there longer than 24 hours. And that doesn't trigger the registration requirement. Okay. And then even states like, you know, Nevada, you want to go to Las Vegas? Well, you have to understand there's a 2-day registration requirement. Chance and I are always recommending people avoid the registration requirement. But if you just can't do that for one reason or another, then, you know, at least put extra time in your schedule to go register. Okay. Because registering is better than getting charged with and convicted of failure to register. And even in California now under the tiered registry law, if you get convicted anywhere of failure to register, it's going to affect when you're eligible to petition. So I'm going to stop at that because we have 3 hands up. John, your hand's up again. Are you able to speak freely? John? I know he said he had a problem in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I'm sorry, John. I think I muted you. There you are.
Yeah. Okay. So for my current job, I travel quite frequently. This is something I've been working with my current probation officer on. So there's a conference I go to in, Nevada in Las Vegas each year that's about, I want to say like 5 days. So you've mentioned if longer in Vegas, longer than 2 days. You also mentioned, being in a hotel outside of the state. So if I were to leave the state and come right back in the same day, does that relieve the obligation? Or if I'm longer than 2 days?
Well, we attorneys have different opinions about that. So my opinion is that doesn't work, but I think Chance has a different opinion.
Yeah, I think it does. If you cross the state lines and you document it and you re-enter the state, but you got to be careful because some states have aggregate totals that you can, you know, per year. So if you exceed the aggregate total, you know, you're, you know, of time you can spend in that state, you still can be in trouble. But I've always been under the impression and the belief that if you are running up against the clock and you leave the state for any amount of time, and let's just say you go, you know, you cross the county line or not the county, but the state line, back into California, go to Starbucks, use your credit card, come back. You've now retold the statute. But again, you have to, I think it's important, because things change all the time. Law is never static. It's always dynamic. And, you know, states change laws. Some states say, look, you know, you can reenter 2 or 3 times. It doesn't matter. It really is unique per state. So it's important to, one, you know, look and get the information you can glean off of our website. And two, maybe see, you know, seek updates based on what you find. You'll find the sections of the law, usually on our website. I think we have really good coverage there. And then you'll look for updates there. And then if you're really, really diligent, you may make a few phone calls and just inquire. And I think that if you do your due diligence, you'll find that you'll have an easier time, you know, determining what you can do exactly. But I do still think that in terms of the Nevada thing, I think that works. Of course, I haven't checked it lately.
And folks, Chance just mentioned something really important, and that is to go ahead and call. So you can call a registration office and you can ask them your opinion. Now be careful because they're not attorneys. Okay. And I think that they're most of the time they're doing their best in helping you, but that may not be good enough. So if you can talk to an attorney in that state. I mean, this is really, really important. Again, failure to register can put you right back in prison, and that's a place you don't want to go. You're always assuming. By the way, I do want to say one thing about the District of Columbia, because remember, we hope to see you in D.C. a year from now. There are no requirements to register if you're visiting the Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. No registration requirement. Okay. I know that. I read it with the law. I talked to the registration office in the past week and one more time confirmed there's no requirement to register in the District of Columbia, no matter how long you are there, if you're a visitor. Now, if you move to D.C., then you have 3 days to register. But if you're visiting, there's no requirement. In the state of Virginia, you have 30 days. You can visit this up to this within the state of Virginia up to 30 days without the requirement to register. Why am I talking about the state of Virginia? It's quite possible that the conference before the vigil will be in the state of Virginia. And we're paying close attention to what the registration requirements are so that people don't need to worry about the registration requirement there. Okay.
Please note that Janice just showed you, illustrated exactly what you need to do in order to feel confident that you're doing the right stuff when you travel. That's a perfect example of what we call due diligence.
I do have a follow-up.
Okay.
To what you said as far as reaching out to the registration office. Now, if I did this with California, like I mentioned, I'm moving there. If I have them email me basically stating they're saying, hey, you don't need to register and that I have attempted to, maybe Chance, this is a better question for you, but would that protect me in saying, hey, they said I didn't need to register when I attempted to?
That really is a case specific question. If I'm going to answer it, probably I should do it, you know, offline. Just give me a call and we'll talk about your situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, when Chance and I give you that answer, we're basically doing it to protect you. Okay. So we don't want you to we don't want you to disclose something privately. This is a recorded call. You know, this is a recorded, actually video. And so whatever is on this recording is on this recording and we cannot protect it. We put it on our website. So it's available to the public. Whoever's phone number ends in 869, I know you spoke earlier, we've unmuted you. Do you have a question or a comment about travel? Ma'am or sir, 869, last three digits. Okay, I'm gonna mute you and move on. John. Just says John. We have more than one John here. So, John, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, my question deals with many Chance's discussion on interstate travel. Okay. What if you're traveling into a SORNA state? When do the SORNA regs start to take effect as far as timelines? If you want to go strictly by reading, all of their regs may apply to registrants. If my travel was, let's say, 10 days prior, started 10 days prior to getting to that state, and I get into that state, does the time limit start when I enter the state, or does it go retroactive to when I started my travel? Got a illusion?
I think he's thinking.
I am thinking. You know, if you're going to go by those regulations, as soon as you enter interstate commerce, they apply to you. It doesn't matter what state you go to. So if you're going to take those regulations and you're going to apply them, you know, once you leave California, they apply to wherever you go. So that's what's so confusing about it. You know, where do they apply? Where don't they apply? You know, second layer stuff. You know, that's why it's good to do this due diligence thing we're talking about. And, you know, as far as the SORNA regulations go, you know, you check out the requirements, you see if there's any updates, you may make some calls and check and see exactly if the jurisdiction that you're going to is applying these things, and then check the requirements so that you're in total compliance. So that's the general answer.
As far as notice in the due process of SORNA and any of the other sex laws and their applicability, without getting written notice from the agencies that are implementing those regs, hasn't it always been that ignorance is no excuse for not knowing what the law is?
I saw that comment in the chat. That has been. But, you know, again, you know, there's a difference between ignorance and knowingly violating the law. Okay, this is a big diff. Okay, and as we understand the regulations and we understand how they're written, there's an element in there of notice, and it, you know, and so you know, we're speaking from what we glean from studying the law and making our recommendations. You got to knowingly do something. You got to be notified of it. And right now, there's been no attempt to notify anybody of anything other than issuing these regulations.
So, folks, there are laws that require scienter. It's like, okay, that's the legal term, knowledge. So there are laws that require prior knowledge. So in other words, that you're knowingly breaking the law. It's like, oh, you know, you didn't know that there was all, here's a crazy law in Texas where I used to live. There was a law that said that you couldn't have wire cutters in your car. Now, that was supposedly an old law. It was a time when, you know, people were driving their cattle and they were cutting people's wire fences down so their cattle could go through. And so it was just one of those stupid old laws that people forgot to take off the books. But technically in Texas, you could get, you know, charged with convicted of having wire cutters in your car, and it was against the law. But I had no knowledge of that till I took a class and a legal class about the law. So there are things like that, but not every law requires knowledge. It's true. So both of these things exist simultaneously. Absence of the law is no excuse. Ignorance, rather, of the law is no excuse. And some laws require actual knowledge. So that's why when it comes to the SORNA regulations, Chance and I say, until the government notifies you that these regulations apply to you, we think you have a good solid defense. We hope you never have to use it, but at least you have a good solid defense. So I'm going to move on now to Gonzalo. You've been waiting, sir. Gonzalo, I'm asking you to unmute. Do you have a question or a comment?
Yes. Gonzalo? So I travel for work as well, and I basically work remotely virtual from my company, but my checks come out of Vermont. I went and updated my information, and the state of Vermont called me to register, and I said, I do not work there. My checks come out of there. I will never step foot in your state. And I only travel to everything California, Oregon, Vegas if I need to, but I'm there for a day and I get out of there, so I don't have to. And Phoenix, same thing with Phoenix. I will never step foot on that side of the country. I don't need to. How do I go about correcting that?
Call Chance or I mean, the thing is, it's how they've written the law, but every law I've ever looked at says you have to actually reside there, right? You know, put your head on a pillow or something, maybe sleep in your car. But yeah, that sounds ridiculous. Just because you get a paycheck. I mean, you're not.
My paycheck says Vermont, and they called me. And I'm like, I don't work there. Well, my company has a location there, and that's where, like, right, the United States location is. But mainly my company's actually out of Canada. but my checks just get printed from there.
And Gonzalo, do you pay Vermont state taxes?
No.
I think somebody's mistaken.
Okay, because I went to update my information and I got a call like a week later. And they're like, hi, calling from Vermont about registering. I'm like, no. My check says they come from there, but I work here.
It sounds like the assumption is because your check comes from there, you must reside there and work there. But totally in error, you know, so.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm not out of compliance or anything of that nature. I go in a few weeks to re-register for my annual. So I will clarify that with them and see what I need to do about, because like I said, I work from home most of the time.
It's funny you say that, because I mean, you know, in law school, we study cases in civil procedure, you know, and you know, these old cases, that you never hear of and they're just bizarre, but you know, one of them was Washington v. Shue, which talked about minimal contacts. I mean, you know, like you do business in the state and you're then you're tied to that state for all kinds of legal liability and so forth. But never have I ever heard this in the realm of registration. So it just sounds like an error to me.
Okay. All right. I will clarify that with them in April and just make sure. Cause I told Vermont, I'm like, no, I don't, I will never step foot in your state. I don't put my head there. There's no reason. I don't cover that part of the country. I only cover the Western section.
Yeah. Thank you. as lawyers, I'm sure that makes both Chance and I kind of chuckle. I was like, that is so freaking ridiculous. I would just love to sue them. But
yeah.
But we don't need to sue them if they decide to do the right thing. Okay. Thank you, Gonzalo. Mm-hmm. I think that's it, Mark. Oh, goodness, I'm losing track. I know you put your hand up a couple of times, so let's try one more time. Mark, do you have a question about domestic travel or a comment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Comment, domestic travel. I travel a lot. So I know you heard somebody say call the registration office in the interstate. I've also, when the law was a bit vague, I called an attorney specializing in these type of cases in another state. He researched for me. And he said, it appears to me you do not have to register in the case you're talking about. Keep my number, keep my name, and on the advice of, you know, attorney. So I felt good getting an actual legal expert from the state, and I just wanted to say that was another method I used. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. I think that was a brilliant thing to do, and encourage you all to do the same thing. And by the way, Chance and I know attorneys that are knowledgeable about sex offense laws in many states, maybe not all 50 states, but a lot of states. And so if you contact me, I'd be happy to give you their name and phone number. And I won't refer you to anybody who doesn't know. but I might tell you we don't have a contact in that state. But it's really a smart thing to do. I know a gentleman who, I know we're talking about domestic, but this has to do with overseas travel. And he was going to travel to Israel. And he did have family in Israel. And he basically got an Israeli attorney before he even left the United States. Yeah. Okay. I think 869, I called on you earlier. Are you there, sir? 869. It's the last three digits. There you are.
Yes.
Do you have a question about domestic travel?
I was having trouble getting my phone unmuted the last time.
Okay.
I'm federal. I don't know if I said that before. But so I have 72 hours to register anywhere I go on the state's registry. And so far I've gotten my probation officer let me travel pretty liberally, and I leave before at about 60 hours if I get stuck behind. And he's never commented on that, and I never really asked him about that. However, if I say were to stay 75 hours and get in trouble for that, it would be a probation violation for me, and I may have to go do some more time. But say Utah is one of the places I go, and I think they give you 5 days. I haven't violated any Utah law, correct? So I'm not in trouble there. Does that sound correct? I'm just in trouble here in California with my probation officer.
I don't feel comfortable answering that question. How about you, Chance?
No, not on a recorded meeting, no. But I make a call to one or other, one or the other. We can certainly assist.
Yeah, please call Chance because he's a criminal defense attorney. Okay, folks, we need to move on to overseas travel. So the big deal about overseas travel is a law, a federal law called the International Megan's Law. And it's got some real nasty provisions in it. So the two basic provisions are, if you have been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, right, then our federal government can and will notify the country to which you are traveling and tell them a person who's been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor is coming to visit your country. Now, is that benign language? Is that terrible language? The federal government keeps arguing that it's factual information, but the problem I see with that language is that it's not benign because the country that's receiving this information is interpreting it according to their own laws. So when you have age of consent, that's so different from country to country. It's my understanding in some countries it's 12, age of consent. In other countries like our country, it's 18, and there's everything in between. Okay, so when somebody reads this as a minor and their age of consent is 12, then my goodness, this person must have had sex with a 9-year-old. Okay, so that's part of the problem. Another part of the problem is it doesn't say when you were convicted of this. So for some people, like Frank Lindsay, I always use him as an example, he was convicted more than 40 years ago. So maybe he did something 40 years ago. Does that mean he poses a current danger? I mean, trust me, I will argue, and I do argue, of course not. He doesn't pose a current danger. So that's the notification provision. And then there's another part, major part of the International Baggins Law, which says if you're convicted of an offense involving a minor and you're currently on any sex offender registry, then you must have a unique identifier in your passport. All right. Now, the unique identifier in the beginning was at the end of your passport, not the very end, but it was hidden in the endorsement pages, like page 27 or some darn thing like that. And so, but they recently moved it up. The unique identifier now is on page 1 of your passport. You open up your passport, and the very first page, it says, this person was convicted of sex offense involving a minor. I'm horrified by that. And, you know, and I'm also, quite frankly, pissed off about it. I'll tell you why. Because when I argued the case challenging the International Megan's Law in front of a federal district court judge, the government attorney said, oh, it's not going to be at the front of the passport. It's going to be on one of those endorsement pages at the end of the passport. Very few people will see it. Well, guess what? They lied. So here they've moved it to the first page of your passport. And anyway, so as far as the unique identifier being in your passport, the International Megan's Law says that the State Department is authorized to revoke your passport. If you have a passport that does not have a unique identifier in it, the State Department can revoke your passport at any time. And it's happened. And I had a client who very unfortunately boarded an airplane in Los Angeles with his wife, and they were traveling to Europe to a Schengen nation that would have been happy to allow them to enter. And the Department of Homeland Security came onto the plane and took him off of the plane. Their bags had been checked. They had their seat. Everything was just fine. They're getting ready to go over there. They paid a lot of money for lodging once they were going to be there. He says to this day, he never got advance notice that his passport had been revoked or any notice. And yet they took him off the plane that day. And oh, by the way, they were celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary. So how's that? So I used to say to people, if you don't have a unique identifier in your passport, you know, that's wonderful. Now I say, go get a unique identifier put in your passport if you're going to travel overseas. Having said that, if you're not going to travel overseas, there's no reason to go get a passport if you don't have a unique identifier in it. It just seems to be hit or miss whose passports are being revoked when they don't have the unique identifier in it. Now, the law does say that the State Department must add a unique identifier in newly issued passports. But the kick in the pants about that is, unless you tell them, unless you specifically ask them to put the unique identifier in there, sometimes they don't do it. And then guess what? You have to get another passport. So I'm sorry about the IML. We tried, you know, Chance, you were a plaintiff in that lawsuit. I had 7 great plaintiffs in that lawsuit. And that was not a good day in court. We had a judge who actually testified at the case. I couldn't believe it. And I really couldn't believe even more what she had to say, which like, oh, well, nobody sees your passport unless you're entering a country. And obviously, to me, she's never traveled overseas, right? Because those of us who have traveled overseas know that you're showing your passport in all kinds of situations. And you go to the bank to exchange money. Sometimes you check into the hotel. You got to show your passport. Sometimes in museums, you have to show your passport, right? And now it's page 1 of your freaking passport is going to say this person's been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. It's just horrible. And, you know, I argued then and I still believe now that that's a terrible thing to do to anybody who's a U.S. citizen. Why? You know, who in the past, in the history of our world, who has ever added anything derogatory like that to their passports of the citizens? The answer is 2 countries. One of them is Nazi Germany. I'm not making this up, okay? I have seen copies of passports that in Nazi Germany where they put a big red J for Jew. Okay. The other country that's ever done it is Russia. And guess what? Also for Jewish people. Now, why in the world would the United States want to join that club of Nazi Germany and Russia, basically identifying people as Jews? So if anybody is Jewish on this, I'm not apologizing to you. I'm sorry. When it comes to this comparison, it is accurate. Chance, why don't you go on, since I've got myself all worked up? And then we have somebody called Zoom user who has a question.
I'll just, you know, add to this briefly that, you know, also it's inconsistent. This just shows you, you know, federal versus state. You know, the definition of minor includes 17-year-olds in the IML, whereas in this country, there's a big divide between what's a minor. Some states say under 18, some say under 17 and a half, some say 16. Okay. No, I don't think there's any state lower than 16, but there is quite a bit of inconsistency when it comes to what is a minor. But for the federal law, IML, it's 17, you know, it's under 18. So that's what they consider a minor. And so you get the endorsement if one, you have a conviction, and two, you're on the registry, on a registry. So if you're a registrant and this has to do with a minor under their definition, you get the marking on your passport and the law pertains to you. Now I saw someone in the chat said, well, does, you know, who does this law pertain to? Well, doesn't it pertain to you if you're a registrant, but the crime involves someone over the age of 18, obviously that this does not pertain to you. So the classifications are in the definitions. And with that, you know, that's my addition to what Janice has said.
Thank you. And by the way, there are countries right now that if they get the notice from the U.S. government that you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, that will not let you enter their country. Huh. Remember, this is not punishment, but those countries are not going to allow you to come in. Right now, most of the countries in Asia are off limits. Don't even try. They'll turn you around. Now, the one place in Asia that has allowed registrants is Hong Kong. And I know that they're having political unrest of their own. The rest of the world's having political unrest. Certainly nobody was going to go to Ukraine right now for vacation. But anyway, in Asia, it's off limits. There's a good website out there. It's the organization is Registrant Travel Action Group. Again, the Registrant Travel Action Group. They have a matrix on their website, and they keep track of which countries are allowing registrants to come visit. And it changes from time to time. You know, sometimes one country will say yes, and then somebody else will say no. And so there's no absolute guarantee there. But why are Chance and I talking about this? Remember I said a few minutes ago about helping you navigate safely through the minefield? This is one part of the minefield. Because if you go to a country, like let's just say you think you want to go to Ireland, okay? You go to Ireland, you're going to pay money for that ticket. There, you're going to get on an airplane. You're going to travel to Ireland. You're going to all this other stuff. You're going to get there. You're tired. You're sleepy and stuff like that. And guess what? The Irish will not let you out of their airport. Okay. They don't care how much time and money you've spent. They're not going to let you out of the airport. That's it. That's it. Your travel to Ireland has just stopped in the airport. And instead, what they're going to do is they're going to put you on a plane to come back to the United States. So we're trying to educate you about where you can and can't go. Now, that's bad news. Don't go to Asia. Don't go to the United Kingdom. But you can go to 26 countries in Europe, and they're called the Schengen nations. And the four largest nations are Italy, France, Spain, and Germany. My kin in Italy, they'll greet you with a plate of pasta and a bottle of red wine, I wish. Anyway, the fact is they'll let you in. They know how stupid our laws are. And they're like, oh, those crazy Americans doing something stupid again, right? But there's 22 smaller nations as well to the four. So if you really need to travel overseas, go to one of the 26 nations in Europe that will be happy to allow you to come in. Don't try to go to those other nations because you will not get in. And, you know, it's even so draconian as if you try to stop and Heathrow Airport in London, they won't let you. They'll send you back, even though that's, you're just staying, you know, you're there, you got a layover and you're going to stay in the airport. They don't care. They're going to send you back to the United States. So you even need to be careful about where your connecting flights are. So you need to avoid the nations that don't want you to be there, because it's quite possible it will basically send you back to the United States and you will have wasted time and money. So Zoom user, you've been handy. You've had your hand up here. I know that you spoke earlier. Do you have a question about overseas travel?
Yes, I do. You guys mentioned some really beautifully said stuff. It's even more shocking than I thought. And I just wanted to know with what they're doing with this international travel, with the identifiers and the constant harassment, would that be considered state sponsored terrorism?
No.
Okay. That's okay. What I wanted to know.
Next question, John.
In the chat.
Okay.
I can.
You're in chat. Okay. See if we can pull it up. If there was no victim, does it still count? That's a loaded question, John. And I'll tell you why. Because if it involved child pornography, there was a victim. So I don't know if you have a CP offense or not, but okay. And I'm serious. If you were convicted of possessing, distributing, producing child pornography, that is an offense that involves a minor. If you are removed and don't have the identifier in your passport, will they still notify the country? If you are removed from the registry, I guess is your question. No, then you would no longer fit the definition of sex offender, provided that you're not required to register in any state. So back to the time when Chance and I were talking about domestic travel and we're telling you, please avoid registering in other states. There are some states out there, folks, that if you ever register in those states, they never take you off the registry. It's not like you have to come back every year, Florida, New York, the two biggest states. If you are ever registered in those states, guess what? They keep you on the registry, not just for the rest of your life, even beyond your death. And it's been tested in court, and so far it's held up. You want to add anything to that, Chance?
No, I think we've covered it pretty good. I think that's that. Just keep this in mind. Maybe just one thing in mind, and that is that you know we're not trying to discourage travel in any way, shape, or form. You know, you can. There are ways to travel and enjoy your travel. Just be really, you know, just do intelligent travel. You know, according to your individual situation. I think that's the message we're trying to get across here.
Right. And I mean, I'm somebody who likes to travel and, you know, I certainly don't want to have any restrictions in my traveling. But if I did have restrictions, I'd want to know what they are so I could avoid them. I guess all I can think of right now is a certain basketball player who's in prison in Russia. You can just think about that. Okay, we've got somebody now ending. Phone number ends in 840. Your hand is up, so I'm asking you to unmute yourself, 840. Okay, looks like you're unmuted, sir or ma'am. Hello?
Hello.
Do you have a question? Do you have a question about overseas travel? Guess not.
Okay.
We're going to mute that person. The next person, six and... Wait a minute. Okay, we have two hands up. 840, are you there? Is that the person I just muted? All right, you can tell. All right. Okay, let's go to 697. You're unmuted. Do you have a question or a comment about overseas travel?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Jeremy. I'm from the state of Texas originally. And in the state of Maryland, I've been exempted, but my questions are, if that state says, what are you contacting us for? Who do you send the notice to that you had posted online, which I have been using? They refuse to take the notice, Janice. So I'm wondering if I just send it directly to the marshals, because that's what Washington, D.C. told me.
The marshals won't take it. And I think maybe, Ken, because of your accent, I didn't understand everything you said. But at the end, you said something about sending something directly to the marshals. I've tried that. even as a lawyer, I tried that and didn't work. So that's not going to work. Did you understand the rest of the question, Chance?
Yeah, I think he said that he was instructed by Washington, D.C., and I'm not sure if that was a smart office or not. Doesn't sound like the smart office. But, you know, we had these issues in California, too, because we're, you know, you're talking about 21-day notice, I think. And, you know, in California, right. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yes, sir, Chance. The problem is that in the state of Maryland, I don't meet the criteria because of the age of complainant. So they're telling me, what's WTH? Why are you even contacting us? So those people that I'm under supervision with, they don't even want to accept the 21-day notice. So that's my dilemma. In Texas, tell me the same thing. Why are you contacting? You don't live here.
So. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm really understanding your question completely, but I would say just give one of us a call so we can get a grip on exactly what the facts and circumstances are.
Okay, yeah, I don't know exactly.
I think I just hung up on him. I'm sorry. Richard, you're unmuted now. Do you have a question about overseas travel?
Yes, you said that if we plan to travel, our passport's still valid. You suggest getting it updated with the unique identifier. And I'm just asking if we know that they are now updating those with the front page information that you described.
Yes. And the reason I'm making that recommendation is because of the person that I told you who was taken off an airplane and, you know, he spent so many thousands of dollars, at least $20,000 on a vacation and didn't get to do any of it. So in order to avoid something like that, I think at this point in time, it's just better to go ahead and request a unique identifier in your passport, even though it's on the first page of the passport. It pains me to say that. But again, in order to avoid something more horrific happening, I think it's the right thing to do. But it's your choice. Okay, let's move on to the person. 840 are the last four digits. 840, I think we tried to get you earlier.
Hello?
Hello? Hi. Do you have a question about overseas travel?
Yes, I do. What about travel to Mexico? Is a passport needed or the ID itself needed to travel to Mexico?
The answer is yes, as Janice would probably have just said.
Yes. Yeah, you have to have a passport and you're going to be turned away if you try to fly there.
Okay, how about if you're driving over the California border into Mexico?
Well, I'm not making a recommendation, but I've heard stories of people doing that successfully.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Next caller ends in 869. You're welcome. 869, asking you to unmute.
Hi, I had the same question about Mexico and South America. You had mentioned Asia and Europe. What about Latin America? Do you have any sense of, in general? I mean, I know Mexico now.
Right. A lot of Latin America is off limits, but really my suggestion is you go to the Registrant Travel Action Group website, and that's what it's called, Registrant Travel Action Group. You Google that. They have a matrix there, and if you look at that, you'll find out. And that information on that website, by the way, and the gentleman who runs it, both Chance and I know him quite well. He's not a lawyer, but what he does is he collects information. People contact him, and then that information is reflected on the website. And it's just based on about people's recent experiences.
Okay. And also, just a comment. I had applied to have my passport renewed with about 8 to 10 months left on my passport before it expired, and they denied it because I was under probation and couldn't travel without permission. And I thought, what? I wouldn't travel without permission. I don't. But now if I ever want to go somewhere, I have to wait for my passport to be renewed or to get a new one. actually, and I don't expect the State Department to rush that through.
I don't know. Chance, I've never heard of somebody be denied a passport because they're on probation.
Yeah, I've never heard of that either. That's the first time I've heard that.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing with us. I mean, folks, when we have these meetings, we're sharing a lot of information. I call them data points, right? And you get enough data points and you can basically draw a picture, an accurate picture. But if you have just one data point, then that's not an accurate picture. Okay. So I think we've done overseas travel as well as we can in the time that we have. So let's move on. We have a lot of people who are interested in the tiered registry law. And this is a California law. And yet there are, I think, other people who might care about what's going on in California under our new tiered registry law. So the bottom line is this, that in California for over 70 years, virtually everybody was on the registry for a lifetime. So Chance and I and Kathleen and others, Joe, we came to Sacramento. We lobbied in Sacramento to create a tiered registry law that would allow some folks to petition, actually to get off the registry. We thought that there should be a group of people who wouldn't even have to petition, including Frank Lindsay, who was convicted in 1979. But we didn't win that battle, but we did get a tiered registry and it is helping some people. So under the tiered registry law, people are supposed to be assigned to one of three tiers. One, two, or three. Tier one is the low tier. Tier three is the high tier. Tier two is the medium tier. So under tier one, if you're assigned to that tier, you have to register for a minimum of 10 years. If you're on tier two, a minimum of 20 years. And tier three, unfortunately, still requires lifetime registration. So is this perfect? No, it is not. Is it an improvement? Yes, it is. Are we going to fight like bloody hell to make it even better? We already started that, and we're going to continue until it's a better law. Or they just adopt the ALI model penal code, right? And then it'll be so much easier. But anyway, I digress. So the petitioning process under the tiered registry law took effect on July 1 of last year. And so because of something called the birthday rule, we have people who are not even eligible yet. I mean, who are otherwise eligible but can't petition because a birthday hasn't taken place after July 1 of last year. So I know some people, you know, are really unlucky whose birthdays were in May and June, or who are in May and June, because they have to wait almost an entire extra year. I apologize for that, but I didn't make up the rules. You can blame the state legislature for that one. Anyway, so here we are. About 9 months into the tiered registry law, and I'm happy to report some people are actually, their petitions are being granted. So it's not automatic. Please understand that, not automatic. Also, if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release, guess what? You cannot petition until you get off of parole, probation, or supervised release. Also, if you're in custody, you cannot petition for removal from the registry. I've actually gotten questions from people in custody or their relatives saying, you know, my person, you know, is otherwise eligible and they're currently in custody for a different kind of offense. I'm sorry, but the law doesn't allow that. If you've been convicted of failure to register, it's going to affect how long you're going to be in, you know, how long it is before you're eligible. Joe's iPad, I'm not sure what's going on there, but it's kind of just, yeah, something. Thank you. It was like a show there, which was a distraction. I apologize. So anyway, so I totally lost my thought. But anyway, the tiered registry law, I know this, the county that's doing the best job in the tiered registry is San Diego, and I know their statistics. They've had 143 petitions filed since July 1. Of that, 69 of them have been granted. So that's almost exactly half have been granted. Only 11 have been denied, and the rest of them are still pending. So I think that's a pretty good track record down in San Diego. Chance and I are filing petitions on behalf of individuals all over the state. I know I've had petitions granted in three counties where I have filed in them. So far, I haven't I've gotten 6 people's petitions granted, and a 7th one I went to hearing this past week, and we don't know the answer yet. It's under submission. So I know somebody has his hand up. Folks, if you have a question about the tiered registry law and how it's being implemented, this is the time, or maybe you have a comment, this is the time to put your hand up, because you got 2 attorneys here who are very actively filing petitions on behalf of registrants. And I know that I feel so wonderful in doing that, because I feel like I'm basically helping somebody escape from prison. How do you feel, Chance?
Well, I've been doing this for a decade before this tiered system came about. I was doing certificate of rehabilitations, feeling the same way, which is, you know, giving folks a second chance at life and getting this horrendous burden off their back. So I share that gratification for doing this type of work. Questions, I'm sure a lot of people have them, and they're probably good questions. So.
Yeah, it looks like we have 4 hands up. And I will make one comment about this. And I think people may not understand that, but after your petition is filed and served, there's a lull. And the lull can last up to 4 months. And what I mean by that is when local law enforcement reviews your petition to see if you're eligible, they tell the DA's office. They don't tell us lawyers most of the time. So it's happened a couple of times that they have shared that information. And then the DA's office, so they have up to 60 days law enforcement. And then the next 60 days, for a total of 120 days, the DA's office has to review your petition, which means 4 months may go by before you get an answer, any kind of indication from the DA's office, whether or not they're going to object to your petition. And it makes a really big difference if they object to your petition. So in the 6 cases that I've had involving the petitions that were granted, in all 6 cases, the DA's office did not object. Okay. The one case that I don't know about, because we had a hearing on the merits, and that was just this week, a couple of days ago, and it's under submission. In that case, the DA's office did object to it. And so we had to, you know, file briefs and have an oral argument in front of the judge in Superior Court. So let's call on John here. John Beasley, sir, do you have a question about the tiered registry law?
I do. I already put it in the chat, but I'm actually able to talk again. So basically my question is, you know, if we have the opportunity, so my charge is originally from a different state, and if I have the opportunity to apply to be removed in 5 years instead of the full 10 years, if I'm able to be removed in that state, will California recognize, you know, the removal from that and allow me to be removed from California as well?
I don't know. I think it's one of those things you're going to have to call Chancellor, right? We'll have to give you specific facts. Yeah. But what state lets you off after only 5 years?
So Utah now, it was a change last year. Basically, if you're on the 10-year registry, you can apply at 5 years to be removed.
That's great news. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah.
Okay, on to John. So 2 Johns in a row, Elisa and then the Charlene. That's the order. John?
Hi again. Could you please specify, both Janice and Chance, specify which counties you're talking about when you're talking about your experiences here? Give us a sense of who's a good county, or what's a good forum to go to?
You know, John, I know you keep shopping there. I will tell you, the hearing that I had on the merits last week was Placer County, and I know that's close to where you live. I've had petitions granted in Contra Costa County, in Los Angeles County, and in San Francisco County.
Thank you.
And Chance, how about you?
Well, I have cases filed everywhere from Eureka to San Diego.
And no, that's where petitions have been granted.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I've had petitions granted in Los Angeles, mainly. Okay. And I still have petitions pending in other places where we haven't gone through the whole process yet. But I do know that there are, as interesting as it may be, there's every jurisdiction is different. And we talk about San Diego as being an ideal jurisdiction. The reason it's ideal is because it's centralized. Los Angeles used to be that way in their remedy for certificates of rehabilitation. But San Diego is centralized, which means everybody's working together. But here's the interesting thing about it. They've roughly gotten half of those granted. Okay, whereas Los Angeles is totally chaotic. And let me put it this way. Really chaotic in terms of, if you look at that petition, you're serving the district attorney and the in where you live, okay, in the county of your residence. It doesn't say anything about a city attorney. The city attorneys process misdemeanors. And so in Los Angeles, there's a real confusion as to who should appear on that petition, just to give you an idea. But the chaotic thing is that the petitions are being sent to the courts where the convictions were sustained in the first place. And they're all over the county. But here is the really weird part. Los Angeles is there's less objections in Los Angeles than anywhere else. And the bulk of these things are being processed and granted in Los Angeles. Interesting enough. So, you know, and I know now I'm litigating in Orange County. I do have a hearing in Orange County. And my understanding is Orange County, which I never thought would even grant one, is granting them, even over the objection of prosecutors. So that's really interesting as compared to counties like San Bernardino, which I'm in also. I should say, yeah, not just Los Angeles. I've had them granted in San Bernardino. And in San Bernardino, some courts are very efficient, but then other courts do really crazy things. Like in Rancho Cucamonga, I just had a summary denial because the proof of service wasn't concurrently served with the petition, which is impossible to do. So, you know, the Department of Justice is going to assist me in ironing that little kink out there. But this is what you're going to get. You're going to get a patchwork of stuff. So the bottom line is, the answer to your question is, even in jurisdictions, you know, where one court seems amenable but another doesn't, there's branch courts and all kinds of things, there's inconsistent results all the way across the board. You don't know until you file. And so that's where we're at right now.
It's so true. I will say, based on my experience so far, the best place is San Francisco County. So far, every petition I filed there has been granted and the DA has not objected. But is it just based on the client? I'm not sure. Okay, Lisa, I know that you have been waiting. So I'm asking you to unmute.
Hi. First of all, thank you for speaking with me last week. My question, I think, is general. My son was convicted in California. I live in Arizona. If he's on the registry, is the only way off of that is proving, getting him vindicated by finding him not guilty of the charge? Am I making sense? Did I state that correct?
I think you did. And the answer is no, because we're talking about this the tiered registry law and the petitioning process. So even if your son was convicted of a sex offense, there, unless he's on tier three, or if he's on tier one or tier two, then he would be able to petition for removal at some point.
Okay, but not on tier three.
Correct.
For now.
And folks, you know, from the very beginning, we have been working with the legislature. It's called lobbying, right? We've asked the legislature to add an off-ramp for people on tier three. Now, they haven't agreed to that yet, but we're going to keep asking until they say yes. And we are tenacious, aren't we, Chance?
We are tenacious, believe me.
All right, Charlene, you're next.
My question is, does a person have to complete the 10 years for tier one before they can petition?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's a minimum registration requirement. Murrieta, looks like it's time for you, sir. You've been waiting so patiently.
Yes, thank you, Janice. I have a friend who moved to North Carolina 30 years ago, and so he's still in the registry here. He's not in the registry in North Carolina, but if he goes anyplace. So anyway, the question is, if he lives in North Carolina, where does he start to remove himself from the registry in California?
Well, here's number one. He's not on the California registry. The fact is, if you move out of the state of California, they take you automatically off the registry. But if he wants to, he could come back to California if he's required to register in California. If he moves back here, he can register again And then he can petition for removal from the California registry. I mean, if he thinks there's some value there, but if he lives in a state that doesn't require him to register, I'm not sure there's value. But folks, please listen to something I said because it's really important. If you leave the state of California, you are automatically taken off the California registry. Now, that doesn't mean the state that you move to is not going to require you to register. They may very well require you to register. But I know that I've been working with some people, and I think you have as well, Chance, who were convicted in California, who moved out of the state. They now live in another state, and they want a petition for removal from the registry. In order to do that, they have to move back to California because otherwise the court doesn't have jurisdiction over them. They can't do it.
I think this is, it's an interesting problem because a lot of people expected that if they were registered in California and they moved out of state, they can simply apply from out of state and have this work as a remedy. But that's not, but as Janice said, that's not how things are done in this state. Once you deregister out, that's exactly what you've done. You've taken yourself off the California registry in this state. This is not Florida. This is California. So in order to get that remedy, as Janice said, you've got to come back. You've got to register and go through the process of being removed officially before you can. And so, again, depends on what your situation is and depends on what you want to achieve, but that's how you do it.
And I will say, I remind people, you can actually be registered in more than one state at a time. Now, is that advantageous? I don't know, but I'm working with somebody who has more than one home. So he decided to come back to California and establish a second residence. And based upon that, he has now petitioned for removal. I know, I'm his lawyer. So I've done it on his behalf. So far, it's not a problem. But in this transition time, he's had to register in both states. So think about it, whether or not you want to do that. Rafael, I'm asking you to unmute yourself, sir.
Yes, thank you again for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I understand that the tier level assessment was based at the risk level at the time of the incident?
No.
This is something that was discussed before?
No. Unfortunately, that's wrong. I wish it were correct. When we went to the legislature and asked them to create a tiered registry law, we asked them to base it upon current risk, and they said no. And so instead, where the tier assignments are based upon the offense for which you were convicted. It has nothing to do with your current risk.
Oh, okay, no, that's what I meant, that it was based on the risk level at the time of your offense.
No. Okay. It's not your risk level. It was precisely what were you convicted of. Now, let me just give you an example. In California, we have 40% of the people on our state registry who pled guilty to or were convicted of the same offense. 40%. We're talking about over 40,000 people. I don't believe 40,000 people did the same thing. But they pled guilty to it. And I've talked to many people who said, I pled guilty to this, but I didn't do it. However, the DA offered me a sweet deal if only I would plead guilty to this. And that offense is 288 parentheses A. It gets confusing because there's another 288A without parentheses, which is different. But what I'm talking about is 288 parentheses A, lewd or lascivious acts with somebody under the age of 14. Okay. Those folks are assigned to tier two.
Okay, so the second leg of my question is, after 41 years from my offense and 24 years on the certificate of rehabilitation, is there any way to go into a reassessment of the tier level application based on so many changes over the time that has passed?
Well, sir... have you gotten a tier assignment and you were assigned to tier three? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is correct. And also I had confirmed or contacted Chance to look into this case. And my problem is that though I was convicted of a date rape with an adult, and at the time we kind of went to the Supreme Court in California to fight the issue of violence, because mine didn't have any violence. The assumption was that I abused a woman while she was drunk. I'm still being assessed as a violent offender. And I thought that there was a confusion on that, because if there is no violence, even though there was an assumed rape, since then, there is no further violence in any way.
I think Chance should answer this. I'm going to mute you, sir.
Well, I'm hesitant to talk about the complexities of this particular case online. Needless to say, a lot of these classifications are classified within the law. Okay. And a tier assignment, as Janice said, is you can go to PC 290 and you can see how the groupings fall, and you can see where people are placed, specifically. So the law is pretty straightforward in telling you where everything is. The only offenses that can come out of tier three are those that were actually tier two, but were assessed at high risk. And if there's been a change in risk, they can certainly be brought down to tier two. Okay. Have we heard of any of those yet? Well, too early to tell, too early to know. But I haven't. I don't know if Janice has, but I haven't. But otherwise, the tiers are pretty well established.
Yeah. Well, it's not, and saying that they're well established does not mean we agree with them. Okay.
But correct.
At this, and by the way, we have, in fact, filed two lawsuits now challenging tier assignments. So in one situation, it's anybody who was convicted of a 288 parentheses C. Remember, we've been talking about 288 A's parentheses A. Now we're talking about 288 parentheses C. It's the same conduct with an older victim. And unfortunately, people convicted of 288 C's are being placed or assigned to tier three. Makes no sense to me. That's why we filed the lawsuit. It's based on equal protection claim. And so we lost at the trial court level and we're now on appeal. But stay tuned. Another one that we filed after that one has to do with anybody convicted of Penal Code Section 288.2. And that one for people is a wobbler. And so for people who had their felony reduced to a misdemeanor, our interpretation of the tiered registry law is those people shouldn't even be required to register. And unfortunately, they're being assigned to tier three. That's a huge difference, right? So so anyway, know that litigation is one way to handle some of these things. We take up litigation like this when there's a group of people, all right? So not one individual, but a group of people. And so I will say the third group that we're going to litigate in a few months from now, maybe in the summertime, is people convicted of felony child pornography offenses. Because right now, everybody convicted of a felony CP offense is assigned to tier three, which makes absolutely no sense. This is a non-contact, non-violent offense, and yet you're getting put into tier three, which is supposed to be the most serious offenses. So stay tuned for that. And, sorry. You know,
Very last question. You indicated in the past that you might have an off-ramp possibility for people that have been assigned to tier three that have been free for a long time.
We've asked for that, Raphael. We haven't gotten it yet. And so getting the tiered registry law took about 7 years. And we understand by Sacramento standards, that was fast. So I don't know how many years we're going to have to go and ask for an off-ramp for tier three. But we'll keep doing it until we get there. So thank you. Zoom user, you've been waiting. And your hand is up.
Thank you. A quick question. Now finding out about how Utah does their registry different with the time frames, I was wondering for the means of getting a passport, could someone move to like Utah and get off the California registry, and then you might not be on a registry there? How does that work? I don't know if you guys understand the question. If I leave the state and I go to Utah and they have, let's say, 10 years instead of a 20 year, like they do here, would I not have to register there, or how would that work?
Well, remember, there's two parts of the international Megan's law. Are you talking about traveling overseas?
Yes.
Okay. So there's two parts of the international Megan's law. The first part has to do with notification, and it has it has no requirement to register. It just says if you were ever convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. So if you were, then that's
I thought it was as long as you were on the registry.
No, it's only the second part of the IML that has to do with the passport and the unique identifier being added to the passport. So if you're not on a, if you're not required to register in any state, they can't add the unique identifier.
But you still have to give them notice to travel?
Yes.
And if you live, if you moved overseas, would you still have to give them notice or you would be out of their jurisdiction?
Well, that's okay. I'm glad that you brought that up, though sad at the same time. So right now, if you live overseas, then you don't have to have the unique identifier. Unless you're required to register in New York or Florida or one of those states that won't take you off the registry. There is a legislation pending in Washington, D.C. right now, and the bill number is H.R. 6522, and Section 201 of that bill, and it's a long bill, it's almost 100 pages long, but so Section 201, it's important for you to know that because you're not going to slog through that whole thing, but Section 201 is basically going to require people who live overseas and who are not on a state registry to get a unique identifier added to their passport. It's not passed. It hasn't become law yet, but I want to tell you that's pending. And I unfortunately predict it's going to become law.
And what if you were going to travel and you're like living overseas? Do you have to give them any type of notice or you're good?
Yeah, there's nobody to give notice to.
Okay. At least that's one good thing. Thank God there's something.
Yeah. But I will tell you too that, you know, even if you don't give the 21-day notice, the fact is these days, the federal government, the United States federal government is basically looking at all manifests for all flights that originate in the United States that go overseas. They're looking at every manifest. And when they see somebody who's required to register, they get flagged and they do. Then the U.S. government sends a notice to the government where you're traveling. So that's even if you don't do the 21-day notice.
Thank you kindly.
You're welcome. Then I wonder, is like, well, then why bother give a 21-day notice? But, oh, well, not all laws are logical. John, you're here again, but I know that you can't often speak. So are you able to speak right now?
I am. And the more that we talk, the more questions I have. So let me, I guess, just first start by saying I have tried to reach out to you. I utilized the number that was on the association's website. Is there a better phone number? Because I believe I've left a few voicemails and I haven't been able to reach you.
All right. Maybe there's a problem with our system. I'll go check it. But everybody, here's my cell phone number. It seems like the whole world has it anyway. It's 805-896-7854. I'll put it in the chat room as well.
Okay,
it's
perfect.
805-896-7854. That is my personal cell phone. If I don't answer it, I apologize. I have a bad secretary. That would be me. But I intend to answer calls that I get within 24 working hours.
Okay. But I guess a point of clarification when I did mention the stuff with Utah and the 10-year being able to apply to be removed at 5, that is for the lowest tier for Utah. And that's like I mentioned, that's recent as of, I want to say April of last year, something, maybe even the year before. I can't remember. It's all been a blur. So you had mentioned that once we move out of California, we're automatically, or, you know, within a time period removed from the California registry. Yes. So if I go back to Utah, right around the time I would be hitting my 5 years, and I move my permanent residence there and I apply and I'm removed from Utah's registry, and then I choose to move back to California, will I need to register again, or will I just be good to go?
I'm not comfortable answering that question in a recorded call. Okay. So if you want to call me privately, fine. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There was a question asked over in chat about the petitioning process here under the tiered registry law. Do you petition in the county where you were convicted, or where you currently reside? The answer is where you currently reside. Okay, so that's really important, folks. You have to petition, file your petition in the right county. If you don't, it's going to get rejected. So again, you file your petition in the county where you currently reside. Trust me, then when it's time to send out copies of the petition, you will be sending it to the county where you're convicted. So they'll have notice and they'll have an opportunity to weigh in. Most of the time, they don't bother to weigh in. I know this was similar under the process that Chance mentioned a short while ago, the certificates of rehabilitation. Also there, the same thing. You petition you applied for a certificate in the county where you reside. Now you petition in the county where you reside. And then you have to notify the county where you were convicted. That's part of the process. So if you hire an attorney, they will do that for you. But it's up to you. I mean, it is possible, humanly possible, for you to file your own petition, for you to prepare it and file it. It is possible. But there's a lot of possible mistakes, tripwires in that process. And like Chance was talking about earlier, one court was getting, you know, cranky with him about the proof of service. And the court was wrong, by the way, but, you know, it's going to take the Department of Justice to correct them. So, you know, and Chance and I forget how many months ago now, it was Chance, I think 6 months ago or more, that we, in fact, did a webinar about petitioning under the tiered registry law. And we basically said many people can do it on their own. Now, some people choose not to do it. And what's one reason? PTSD. I have clients who do not even want to go into a courthouse, much less a courtroom if they can avoid it. And I will tell you, this past week, when I went in Placer County with a registrant and his petition, you know, the DA had objected to his petition, he was invited inside the well of the court. He was there in the courtroom with me. He stood up. And when the judge invited him to come inside the well, that means the part, you know, where the judge is, the bailiff and everybody, he refused to go inside the well. And I know exactly why he refused to do that, because he has PTSD. And he was so concerned that if he went inside that well, what was going to happen is they would put handcuffs on him and take him to jail. And even though I said many times that's not going to happen, he made sure it didn't happen, he thought, by staying outside the well. But, you know, we all have our levels of comfort. Okay, Tom, you got your hand up? So I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Yes. I filed my own petition for a removal here in Michigan based upon our new laws. And the judge was kind enough to grant me that petition. I could not afford an attorney, so I had to do it myself. It was a struggle without any kind of legal advice. And, of course, our court, clerks are mandated not to give out any particular information. And unfortunately, most attorneys, they wouldn't give me any information until I had paid them no money. So anyways, I had to work it through myself, and I did. However, in regards to that gentleman who refused to step into the well, first time I went into the court, I was in real fear that I may have done something wrong, and they were going to slap the cuffs on me and haul me away. After the first time, and about four heart attacks later, for real, I was able to get back into court, and I figured, it's better to be off the list than go through this the stress of going to court. So it worked out, and I'm very happy to be off the list early.
Well, congratulations, Tom, and I commend you on your courage and your tenacity, because that's what it takes. It does. And whether you're with a lawyer or you're not with a lawyer, I guess that heart's still beating twice as fast as it normally does. So congratulations.
Thank you.
You're a great example. Thank you. Okay, I think we have run out of people asking us questions. Chance about this topic. So I think it's time to move on. We have the topic of military retirees being denied access to military bases. Right before we go there, I want to mention again, March 2023, so a year from now, please join us in Washington, D.C. We've got some important business there. We have an opportunity. We're going to take the opportunity to educate the U.S. Supreme Court and the public, quite frankly, as well, as to why Smith versus Doe is a mistake and how it needs to be corrected. Okay, so when it comes to registrants being denied access to military bases, unfortunately, this came to my attention last fall. And when I was told that somebody who was a military retiree, actually retired military officer, was denied access to the base that lives down, which is down the street from where he lives. And I was appalled. I was absolutely appalled at that, and I quickly called a friend whose husband is on a similar circumstances and said, beware, this is what just happened. And what we've been able to uncover is that there's a new policy, and I'm putting that in air quotes, policy, regulation, directive, whatever we're going to call it here, that basically says that anybody who was convicted of a sex offense, I'm sorry, anybody who's currently required to register as a sex offender cannot come on a military base for any reason. And to me, I find that totally shocking. I'm a veteran myself. I'm not a retiree, however, but I remember, you know, that carrot that was dangled in front of my nose. Well, gosh, gee whiz, just give us 20 years. We'll take care of you for the rest of your life, right? Your medical care, you can go to the base exchange, you can go to the commissary, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what's happening. And so as bad as this is, it makes it a little bit worse that nobody got prior notice. So people are all over the country. This is not just happening in California, but all over the country. Retirees are going to the front gate to go on the base for whatever proper reason they're going on to the base, only to be told, nope, we're not going to let you on our base. And so we have prepared a lawsuit. The lawsuit hasn't been filed yet. We're polishing it just a little bit more before we file it, but we take this issue very seriously, and we want to address it in federal district court. I imagine this could be a long haul. I mean, I can't imagine the military is just going to immediately say, oh yeah, you're right, we made a mistake. But think about it. So anybody who's currently on the registry, and, you know, again, in California, we have people on the registry for 50 plus years. So your offense occurred when? and so, I mean, the assumption, right, in doing all this is that you pose a current danger. And the question is maybe whether they ever pose a danger, but certainly now, if it's been X number of years afterwards, then what the heck, what is this about? And we're talking about people, too, who did not do anything. You know, their offense, their conviction offense didn't occur on a military base. I mean, maybe then those people should get a little extra scrutiny. But at this point in time, the policy is if you're currently on a registry, or if you were ever convicted of, let me find it just a minute, my notes, a rape, child molestation, sexual assault, or child pornography. Any of those offenses, if you were ever convicted of that, even if you're not currently required to register, then in fact, you're going to be denied entry. Now, how does this happen? I mean, most of us, I remember when I was on active duty, the person at the front gate, you know, is probably a really junior person. And sometimes I'd say not the brightest bulb, but most of the time they're a junior person, right? And they had like little or no authority, except they had a gun, right, that they could point at you to tell you don't come on the base. So here we are. There's a system called DBIDS, which is an acronym. You know how the military loves their acronyms. So the DBIDS system now has been merged with the sex offender registries in every state. And so that's how they know whether or not somebody's on the registry. And that's what they're using as the basis for denial. So I know at least one person, a couple people who are on right now, you've had some experience with this. Do you want to make a comment? Do you have a question? Do you want to talk about it or not? And somebody here is in their call is 042. I'm sorry, the phone number ends in 042. Do you have a question or a comment about this issue or another issue? 042, you're unmuted.
Yes, Janice, how are you doing?
Okay.
Janice, you there?
Yes, we can all hear you.
Yes, this is in regards to the last with tier registry real quick. You were transferring over to this subject, and I was trying to press star 9, and it okay. didn't happen. But real quick, 1993, I was convicted of a 61-220, and I have a COR on my file, had it for 10 years, and I was placed on TBD. What are my chances of, my birthday's in April, petitioning for a removal from the registry?
Well, you can always submit a petition, but it's probably not going to be successful until you get your tier assignment. So you brought up a really good issue and some important issue. So let's talk about that briefly. So even though the California Department of Justice should have assigned everybody a tier by now, the fact is about 20 to 25% of the people have not gotten tier assignments yet. And if you think 108,000 people, we're talking about 20,000 to 25,000 people who don't have a tier assignment yet. And my experience has been with the courts and with the DA's offices, by the way, is they don't want to process a petition if your tier hasn't been assigned. Now, I know, Chance, you were successful in getting somebody's petition granted, even though they didn't have their tier assignment. I have not had that experience. And, you know, I feel like it's my duty as an attorney to tell my client when the DA's office is objecting to the petition because they don't have a tier assignment. And in all of the cases, my clients have said, withdraw my petition. So we will refile the petition after they have their tier assignment. So question, you know, begs the question, does California DOJ have a deadline for signing tiers? They do. The tiered registry law gives them a deadline, which is January of next year. So January 1st of 2023, then California DOJ is supposed to have all the tier assignments completed. Do I think they're going to have them all completed? No, I do not. So I say that because they've also not met other statutory deadlines and we'll probably have to sue them in January of next year. But until that happens, you know, it's up to you. You can file your petition or have an attorney file it on your behalf, but I doubt it will be successful.
And yeah, okay. Let me just add to that. It depends really on the jurisdiction and depends on who's handling it. So, you know, and it's a roll of the dice. So you can, or you can't. And the thing is that the way I see it, and this is just my particular practice, the reason I file them is because one, either the determination might be made during the interim of a filing. So that will clear that up. Or two, no determination will be made, but because it's an in-state conviction and because the CSAR comes back, let's just say this is a simple conviction. It's an old case where they just don't have the records. The report comes back, the initial report comes back from law enforcement showing no federal convictions, one simple conviction that's easy to ascertain. The law doesn't say anywhere that we're barred from making that determination, that we can make it between the district attorney and ourselves and the court, and that it can be granted. So it's a situational thing, and it depends on the complexity of the case and your willingness to push the envelope. So, you know, that's where it's at.
Yeah. I'm out of LA County, LA courts. So, and when I got my COR back in the day, they were pretty liberal about it. The judge was like more than happy to give it to me. But, you know, I still can't get up until I get a pardon. But I'm definitely going to give you a call because I'm willing to do this, take it the next step and get this petition going.
Okay.
April when my birthday comes up.
Okay.
So you'll be hearing from me, sir.
Very good.
All right. Thank you. John, if you're in a place where you can talk right now, we're asking you to unmute.
John? Yeah. Yes. I guess, yeah, I think I can say it. Basically, I'm prior service as well. And basically, my question is, you know, once I'm no longer required to register, since you said the systems are connected, excuse me, to the registry, would I be authorized to enter the base after that point, or is there a way for them to check based on a prior conviction?
Well, I listed briefly, and I'm going to repeat now. according to their policy, if you've ever been convicted of an offense involving child pornography, sexual assault, child molestation, or rape, you still will not be able to get on the base.
Okay, yeah, mine aren't those. So.
Okay, all right. Then
and it'll be dropped to a misdemeanor. So.
Okay, great. Then you should be clear. Okay, we have somebody with the final digits of 869 who's got their hand up. Please unmute yourself.
Hi. I'm wondering, as far as the notice of the TIER notifications, I haven't received mine yet. It's the State Sex Offender Registry. Will I get my TIER notification from the state, or will I get it from the feds?
Neither one. You have to go to your registration office to get your TIER assignment letter. This is a...
Okay.
I'm sorry?
I have to request it?
Yes, you have to go there. Well, in some jurisdictions, they're allowing people to make phone calls. Other times, you have to go there in person. A very few times, I understand that, in fact, they will send it to you by email. But this is a part where the California Department of Justice said that they don't have enough money to mail you a letter. So, yeah, you have to go to your registration office in person.
Okay, well, and this is pretty specific, but is Sacramento one that is allowing you to call?
I don't know.
To do something?
I don't. Okay. Even though I live in Sacramento. You're welcome. Okay, Ron, please unmute yourself.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Very good. Yeah, I'm Ron, and I'm living in the state of Virginia, military, Air Force, retiree, 27 plus years. And we spoke before on this, which was first started. I didn't give you any detail, but bottom line is I live in the national capital area and have access to obviously multiple bases, or I should have access, I should say, for medical care. Primarily, I'm at Fort Belvoir, and I've been denied access on the 7th of November, and I haven't been back since. And I have yet to start the process of appealing to them for access. That being said, I'm concerned about, obviously, if and when I get approved for access to Fort Belvoir. Oftentimes, medical appointments aren't necessarily on Fort Belvoir. It could be anywhere like, you know, Bethesda, Walter Reed, Malcolm Groh, and Andrews Air Force Base. So it's going to cause a problem there in terms of the need to get approval for each of those installations. That being said, it's a little intimidating going through that process. I'm going to get it done. But in terms of the lawsuit that you're intending to file, is it possible that I could become a plaintiff on that lawsuit, or how would I get my name on that lawsuit, or help you assist you in potentially reviewing it before it's filed?
Yeah, Ron, I'd love you to contact me directly. So if you don't have it already, my phone number is 805-896-7854. Again, 805-896-7854. My email address, everybody, is J as in Janice, M as in Mary, my last name Bellucci, so jmbellucci@aol.com. Yes, I am an AOL dinosaur. I am an AOL dinosaur, as my children tell me.
I was just going to ask, when would be the best time to contact you via phone, voice, during the weekday or something like that?
Yeah, I'd appreciate during the week if you don't mind.
Sure. I'll wait till Monday. No problem. We'll chat with you on Monday, hopefully.
Okay, great. I really appreciate that. And yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate
that. You're welcome. And you know, so I understand very much what Ron just said. And so the lawsuit that we have drafted, but not finalized, addresses the issue, which is just because you're allowed to go on one base doesn't mean that you can go on another base. And so, I mean, what about this, the undue burden of having to go to each and every base, military base, and appeal the denial, right? I mean, I guess there are hundreds, if not thousands, of military bases in the United States of America. And okay, we got some overseas as well. And military retirees are supposed to be able to access military bases. And there's no exceptions, and certainly not because you were convicted of an offense, long ago. And again, too, it was like, and you weren't on active duty, and it didn't happen on a military base. What business is it of the military then? Because quite frankly, I think that the burden should be on them to prove that you are a current danger. But That's what our lawsuit's all about. Goodness. Ron, you just spoke. Okay. So,
yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Certainly. Thank you. So folks, we're at the end of the dance here, as far as issues, and I think we've addressed them all. I want to thank you all for, sticking, with us this whole time. At least half of the people did the full 2.5 hours. I don't know about you, Chance, but I could use a break. And I hope that each and every one of you will go onto our website and sign up to get notices from us. And notices include meetings like this, that you'll know that they're coming up. You don't have to, you know, if you're going to forget about it or something like this, you get these gentle reminders from us. By the way, we never share your contact information with anybody. You know, I am in fact the only person who sees the contact information. Well, me and one person, our webmaster, Roger, sees it, but nobody else sees it, and we protect it to the nth degree. So again, thank you so much for being here today. If you think we've given you any valuable information, we hope that you'll make a donation on the website. The website address is www.allforconslaws.org. But most of all, thank you for being here today, and I hope that we've been able to help you in some small way. Chance.
Thank you again for being here, as Janice said, and have a wonderful weekend, and we look forward to another meeting soon in the future. Thanks a lot.
See you all next month. Take care. Bye-bye.